Good morning. This is the regular meeting of the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board on Thursday, June 20th, 2019. We'll start with the Pledge of Allegiance led by Board Member Noren.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, our nation, under God, indivisible.
So we'll go through some introductions. To my far right is Hector Bedoya of Healdsburg. To his left is Greg Giusti of Ukiah. To my left is David Noren of Sebastopol. To his left is John Corbett of McKinleyville. And on the far left we have Kelly Gant of Trinity Center. And I am Valerie Quinto of Santa Rosa. Matt, would you like to introduce staff?
Good morning, Board Chair Quinto. Matt St. John, Executive Officer. To my right is Nate Jacobson, Senior Counsel to the Board. Across from me is Patty Corsi, helping out today. And various staff will introduce themselves throughout the day.
Thank you. Do we have any board member reports on ex parte communication outside the normal course of business? Great, Board Member Corbett.
Am I on? Yeah. I just want to say I saw a presentation of the California Association of Water Agencies on the head of Cal EPA, our new our State Water Resource Control Board chair, and the head of Cal EPA. First of all, the millennials have arrived. We've been waiting. So they're that young millennial group. They are very much into deadlines, I can tell you that. So if our staff negotiates or the board chair negotiates for a deadline, we tend to be a little bit more generous in extending them than some. I wouldn't extend it with these people. I mean, three times in the speeches I heard, we don't want excuses. The governor wants it done on the deadline. So that will change. In 2 years, it'll be very different because I've seen other high ambition people. But during this time period, I'd be very careful that if they have dates, we ought to make sure we extend that. They're quite a bit into deal making, and we've gone through different eras of that. The problem with deal making is that tends to be the big players get in the room and small players, and we're a small player, don't. So we have to figure out how to align ourselves with big players and have our executive director, big players, so if anything should come in that affects us, that we get a place in the room. The only thing I could see if something happens in the Klamath, but a little hard to predict, but that's the other thing. And then generally, two or three other administrations I've seen that have been into deals, if you come back 4 or 5 years later, they get into the productivity of having common regulations for everybody gets lots done, and more than individual deals, because you have to have very important issues for that. So that's just my overall impressions. I thought I'd pass it on. They're very youthful, they're very enthused, and looking forward to it.
Madam Chair, it's not an ex parte, but I thought I'd let board members know that myself and Hector Bedoya participated in a staff workshop with the dairy community and interested stakeholders with staff. There was a private meeting to begin with, and then there was a public part of it afterwards. It was really good. There was a lot of dialogue, I thought, that was really productive, and I believe they're working towards bringing that permit back for reconsideration in August, but it was really a good conversation. Very good job by staff.
The next item is State Board Liaisons, Board Chairs, Board Members, and Executive Officers Report. Our State Board Liaison is not able to be here today. Matt, do you have any comments that you want to share at this point?
I'll do my oral EO report at the end of the agenda today.
Okay. Great. Okay, moving on to public forum. This is the time for comments from the public on items that are not on today's agenda. I have one comment card, so if there's anybody else who would like to provide comment, please fill out one of these pink cards and pass it forward. Susan Fricke.
Good morning, Board. It's great to be... Good morning, Board. This is Susan Fricke with the Creek Tribe. It's great to be back in front of you again. I'm glad I could come down to this meeting and see you all in person again. And I just wanted to say that we're at the Creek Tribe. We're really looking forward to our government-to-government meeting that we're having on July 8th in Sacramento. It's with the State Water Board and your guys' staff, the Regional Water Board. We've got several items that would be interesting to talk about. So if any of you are interested in that as well, we'd love to see you, have you participate in that meeting. And we like to take things to that government-to-government level just to make them a little bit more formal sometimes. So we appreciate your staff bending over backwards to come to that meeting with us. I'm also now on part of the Shasta Water Groundwater Advisory Committee meeting. I'm one of the members, and that's related to the SGMA process. And one of the things that I had noticed was missing from those meetings, I just joined in, I think, December or January, so I've only attended about three or four of the meetings, was your staff's presence there, especially when they're talking about putting in money for proposals for grants and things like that, and like, you know, things that are like $6 million. And I thought that the overlap with the SCOT and the Shasta TMDLs and the implementation projects that we've been talking about and planning with these ranch management plans for years would be a great overlap for some of those projects, because groundwater and surface water is, in fact, interconnected. And so if we can have things that fix surface water, we have things that also fix groundwater in those basins. And I've talked to Matt, and it sounds like we definitely will have some staff attending those meetings now, which would be great to have their technical expertise there and some of their guidance there with those meetings. So I'm really looking forward to having some of the staff for those. Thanks.
Madam Chair, can I ask?
Yes.
Pardon me. Did you say the Shasta, or is it Shasta-Scott combined?
The Shasta and the Scott are separate. The Creek Tribe has a seat on the table for the Shasta, but we were not allowed one for the Scott. And Crystal is there from Quartz Valley, but they wouldn't let us in on that one.
And that's the GSA, Susan, or is that the advisory group?
It's the advisory group.
Okay.
Just
great.
That.
Thank you so
much. But it's
much.
Something.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you. Any other members of the public wishing to provide comment at this point? Okay. We'll move on to action items, starting with item two, which is approval of meeting minutes from April 17th and 18th.
Madam Chair, I'll give you a motion to adopt
the meeting minutes from the, what was that meeting, duck on it, just looking at it. I apologize. When was this? April 18th, 2019.
Second.
Okay, clarification that it was 17th and 18th?
Duly noted.
Thank you. Okay, Patty, please call the roll.
Board Member Bedoya.
Aye.
Board Member Juicy.
Aye.
Chairwoman Quinto.
Aye.
Board Member Norin.
Aye.
Board Member Corbett.
Aye.
Board Member Gant.
Aye. It's approved. Moving on to item three, and I'll turn it over to Matt for the 2020 board meeting schedule.
Thank you. So the purpose of this is for the board to approve the 2020 board meeting schedule, and I corresponded with board members via email proposing the following dates. We're suggesting to continue the pattern of having six scheduled two-day board meetings in 2020, which is the pattern that we've been doing this current year. Suggesting switching from Wednesday-Thursday meetings to Thursday-Friday meetings for the following dates. February 6th and 7th, April 16th and 17th, June 18th and 19th, August 20th and 21st, October 15th and 16th, December 10th and 11th. And via email, I didn't hear of any known conflicts other than the possibility that Ms. Gant won't be in the country in for the April meeting. So at this time, be happy to hear from any of you if you have any concerns with the proposed schedule.
Madam Chair, Board Member Gant. So I talked to Matt about this, and my commute down to Santa Rosa is 6 hours. So I usually spend the night after our board meeting. And if we go to a Friday, so instead of me having to travel home on Saturday, kind of screwing up the weekend, I would propose that Friday be our short day. So Thursday, a full day, and it just gives the option that I can actually get home on a Friday.
I think that would be great. It's always nice to have a short day on a Friday.
There's no place like that.
It's true.
Madam Chair. Matt, have you predetermined any of these dates that will not be in Santa Rosa, that will be on the road?
Have not predetermined that. Okay. It is our typical practice is to have the April and the October. When we have away board meetings, they're typically in the spring and in the fall, and so likely in April or October. But my preference is to leave it open at this time and see how particular agenda items shape up to determine the locations of the meetings.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, then I think it's time for a motion.
Madam Chair, I would move that we adopt the schedule for the 2020 actually board schedule.
I second.
Okay, Patty, please call the roll.
Board Member Bedoya.
Aye.
Board Member Giusti.
Aye.
Chairwoman Quinto.
Aye.
Board Member Noren.
Aye.
Board Member Corbett.
Aye.
Board Member Gant.
Aye.
Okay, great. Moving on to uncontested items, we have items 4 through 6 on the agenda are uncontested. Is there any member of the board who wishes to pull those from the uncontested calendar for discussion? Or any member of the public that wishes to comment on any of those items?
Madam Chairman, I'll move the consent calendar, 4 through 6.
I second.
Board Member Bedoya.
Aye.
Board Member
Duke. Aye.
Chairwoman Quinto.
Aye.
Board Member Norris.
Aye.
Board Member Corbett.
Aye.
Board Member Gant.
Aye.
Okay, excellent. Now we are on to information items. Item 7, which is an update on the implementation of order number R1-2015-0021.
All right. Hello, Chair Quinto and members of the board. My name is Forrest Fortescue. I am an engineering geologist and member of your staff in the Northern Non-Point Source and Forestry Unit. And today I am the liaison to Klamath and Modoc National Forests in our federal waiver program. And today I will provide an update on implementation of order number R1-2015-0021, waiver of waste discharge requirements for non-point source discharges related to certain federal land management activities on national forest system lands in the North Coast region. Through the course of this presentation, I will refer to this permit as the federal waiver or just the waiver. So this is today's agenda. My presentation will take about 30 minutes, and there will be opportunities for the board to comment after each of the three presentations that are scheduled. Staff from the BLM will follow with a 15-minute presentation, and then the Forest Service will present a panel presentation that should take about 45 minutes. We will then hear from members of the public and end with another round of questions and answers from the board. So here's my presentation outline. I'm going to start with an overview of federal lands in the North Coast region and then move on to the federal waiver. I'll describe several moderate risk activities that are covered by the waiver, go through the monitoring and reporting program, and end with a discussion of some potential revisions to the next iteration of this permit. The image on the right shows the 6 national forests in our region. The 6 rivers, Klamath, Modoc, Shasta Trinity, and Mendocino National Forests are in the Forest Service Pacific Southwest region. And the small portion of the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest, which is difficult to see, but there are 2 little spots up there, are in the Forest Service Pacific Northwest region. To start, here's an overview of federal lands. The shaded areas on the figure on the right show all federal land ownership in the region. Federal lands cover 46% of the total land area, and of that, 41% are national forest system lands, and the remaining 5% are administered by other federal agencies, including the Bureau of Land Management, National Park Service, and the other agencies identified on this slide. Given the Forest Service's administration of a large percentage of the federal lands in the North Coast region, many of the topics I will discuss in today's presentation deal directly with the Forest Service. So common land use activities on federal lands in our region include vegetation management, fire recovery, livestock grazing, road management, recreation, including administration of off-highway vehicle and hiking trails, in-channel restoration, and mining. And in-channel restoration and mining activities are not eligible for coverage under this waiver because they are covered under other water quality permits. Now, here is an overview of the history and structure of the waiver and an update on its implementation. These are some key pieces of legislation and agreements that have informed the development of our waiver program. I want to focus on the non-point source policy, which required each regional water board to address non-point source discharges through some combination of waste discharge requirements, waivers of waste discharge requirements, or basin plan prohibitions. And that moves us to an overview of the development of our federal waiver. Waivers have a 5-year lifespan, and we are currently on the third iteration of our federal waiver. The 2004 Forest Service waiver accomplished some of the requirements of the non-point source policy by covering timber harvest activities on national forest system lands. The 2010 Forest Service waiver expanded to cover many more non-point source activities, including fire salvage, grazing, and roads projects. And the current waiver, which was adopted in 2015, expanded again to cover other federal agencies in the region. It allowed for the coverage of large fire salvage projects and expanded the monitoring and reporting requirements. That federal waiver expires in October of 2020, which leads us to today's presentation. The federal waiver is structured to rely largely on federal best management practices, as well as protection measures contained in regional management plans, such as the Northwest Forest Plan and Aquatic Conservation Strategy, as well as local management plans, like an individual national forest land and resource management plan. The monitoring and reporting program is similarly structured to rely largely on Forest Service monitoring programs and protocols. The waiver only covers activities with a low to moderate risk to water quality. Activities that the executive officer determines pose a high risk to water quality would be covered under an individual permit. A major goal of this waiver is to require federal agencies to demonstrate reasonable progress towards addressing impaired waters and TMDLs established and on federal lands. Now I'm going to walk through the process of evaluating and enrolling projects under the waiver. Regional Water Board staff start by reviewing the NEPA schedule of projects under development as published by a federal agency. We then review and comment on initial project scoping documents as they are posted to that NEPA schedule, and then we comment on project draft environmental documents as those projects move through the NEPA process. In our comments in all phases in this process, we provide federal agencies with project-specific comments regarding waiver compliance. And once a NEPA document is signed and final, we then make a determination as to whether the activities in that project pose a low, medium, or high risk to water quality. Low-risk activities, such as Christmas tree harvesting, firewood cutting, and road maintenance, are covered under the waiver under Category A. Category A projects are automatically enrolled and do not require monitoring. Moderate-risk activities, such as post-fire recovery, vegetation management in situations where there is a potential of discharge of sediment, road stormproofing, road decommissioning, and grazing allotments, are covered under Category B of the waiver. Many of the activities I will discuss in the remainder of this presentation are Category B activities. And Category B projects require federal agencies to submit an application for waiver coverage. Legacy sediment site treatment is required for most Category B projects for protection of water quality objectives and to demonstrate reasonable progress towards implementation of sediment and temperature TMDLs. So then Regional Water Board staff review the application And once the application is deemed complete, the executive officer enrolls the project under the waiver. Some activities on federal lands are not eligible for coverage. These include active mining operations, as well as cleanup of toxic mine sites, activities that require a construction or industrial statewide stormwater permit, and activities that require a Clean Water Act Section 404 dredge and fill permit and 401 certification. Some federal management and fire recovery projects enrolled under the federal waiver had in-channel restoration activities that required a 404 permit, and in those cases, we informed the federal agency during project scoping that the portions of that project that required a 404 permit would not be eligible for coverage under the waiver, but the remaining portions of the project that were would be eligible for coverage. And as stated previously, activities that pose a high risk to water quality are not eligible for coverage under this waiver. A large component of Regional Water Board staff review of federal projects is evaluating proposed legacy sediment site treatment contained in waiver applications. As background, during the 19th and 20th centuries, large portions of federal lands in our region were managed for large-scale timber production and mineral exploration on hill slopes and adjacent to watercourses. The legacy of historic road building, logging, and mining created a huge number of potential sediment-producing sites across the landscape. The impact of these sites are commonly felt after legacy sites blow out and deliver sediment to streams during large-scale or during large triggering events. And the undersized culvert shown on the left is an example of a watercourse crossing that has the potential to deliver sediment to a stream if it fails. Through developing the source analysis of many of the sediment and temperature TMDLs in our region, Regional Water Board staff have determined a primary driver of those impairments to be these legacy sources of sediment. Therefore, fixing legacy sediment sites across the North Coast region has been a focus of our office's non-point source pollution control program for many years. In most of the components of the waiver rely on existing federal policies and programs. However, in many cases, treatment of legacy sites is a requirement of the waiver specifically and goes beyond the requirements of a typical federal project or federal best management practices. Legacy sediment sites have the same definition as a controllable sediment discharge source in our general waste discharge requirements permit for private timber harvest plants. And thus, a legacy sediment site is any site that is discharging or has the potential to discharge sediment to waters of the state in violation of applicable water quality requirements, was caused or affected by human activity, and may feasibly and reasonably respond to prevention and minimization measures. The waiver requires federal agencies to inventory, prioritize, and treat legacy sediment sites within project areas of Category B projects, and to complete that work during the time frame of the project, which typically is less than 10 years. Throughout the implementation of the federal waiver, we have received feedback from federal agencies and the Forest Service specifically that the legacy site treatment requirements place a strain on the limited resources of federal agencies. In part to address those concerns, the waiver affords federal agencies some flexibility in developing treatment plans. For projects that cover a large area, such as a fire recovery project, agencies can propose an alternative legacy sediment site treatment plan. An alternative plan allows federal agencies to propose treatment of only a subset of sites that pose a high risk to water quality, and that plan is subject to EO approval. The waiver also allows agencies to trade treatment of legacy sediment sites within project areas for other sites in the same sub-watershed. And if a project is located within a priority watershed as defined by the Watershed Condition Framework, priority level legacy site treatment is not required if a watershed restoration action plan has been developed and enrolled under the waiver. Watershed Condition Framework is a Forest Service restoration program that prioritizes restoration at the sub-watershed scale, and a watershed restoration action plan is the implementation plan for that restoration. This chart shows all of the Category B projects enrolled under the federal waiver, under this term of the federal waiver, by year. Of the 33 enrolled projects, 32 were national forest projects and one was a Bureau of Land Management project. During the period of the current waiver, staff have evaluated portions of every national forest in the region, and we've also looked at several projects proposed by the Bureau of Land Management and the National Park Service. Note the projects in red are post-fire recovery and salvage projects. It is worth mentioning that the 6 post-fire recovery projects enrolled under the waiver account for more total acres than all other projects combined. Here is a list of some of the meetings we have had with federal agencies since the adoption of this federal waiver. We've worked closely with all of our agency partners on implementation and development, and we continue that effort today with the presentations you will hear from Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service. And now I will speak more detail about several moderate risk activities that are covered by the waiver, starting with vegetation management. I use the term vegetation management here to refer to both timber harvest and fuel reduction activities, and we have enrolled over 50,000 acres of these projects under Category B of the waiver. Vegetation management activities include site preparation or using mechanical equipment or burning to clear undergrowth and encourage development of planted tree species, pre-commercial thinning of small trees to encourage faster, larger tree growth, and both non-commercial and commercial timber harvest. Also, since the adoption of the Northwest Forest Plan in 1993, even-age management, also known as clear cutting, is not permitted in green tree sales on federal lands in the North Coast region. Over the past several years, the focus of many vegetation management projects has shifted from developing a classic timber sale toward reducing hazardous fuels on federal lands. Common fuel reduction treatments include thinning vegetation near communities, as well as reducing fuels around private properties, establishing and maintaining ridgetop fuel management zones, conducting controlled burns, and removing roadside hazard trees. Many of these fuel reduction activities are commonly proposed in both vegetation management and post-fire recovery projects. And that leads to the next topic, which is post-fire recovery. This figure shows National Forest System lands in the North Coast region, along with the perimeters of wildfires that occurred in 2008. You will now see an animation that shows all wildfires that have burned in the North Coast region since then. Over 26% of the federal land in the region has burned since 2008, and that adds up to over 1.5 million acres of land. We all understand that the tempo and intensity of wildfire seasons has increased over the past 10 years. In response to landscape level changes caused by large wildfires, post-fire response has become a major priority for federal agencies in our region, especially on National Forest System lands. We've enrolled 6 fire recovery projects that encompass over 53,000 acres under Category B of the waiver. 3 national forests have prepared fire recovery projects, and these projects typically include a mix of fuel reduction and timber harvest, or salvage harvest activities. Most fire recovery projects require preparation of an environmental assessment or environmental impact statement, in contrast to the streamlined emergency notice process required on federal lands after a wildfire. 2 alternative legacy sediment site plans were approved for fire recovery projects, and in total, the Forest Service has committed to treat 501 legacy sites across all of the fire recovery projects. Here's an example of a fire recovery project, one that some of you may be familiar with. The West Side Fire Recovery Project was developed by Klamath National Forest in response to the 2014 West Side fires. Those 3 fires, the Beaver Fire, White's Fire, and the Happy Camp Complex, combined to burn over 180,000 acres and burned through portions of the Mid-Klamath, Scott, and Salmon River hydrologic units. The final environmental impact statement for the West Side Project was signed in 2016, and the project was enrolled under the waiver soon after. The project proposed over 24,000 acres of fuel reduction activities, as well as over 5,500 acres of salvage harvest, though Klamath National Forest didn't harvest all of that timber. The project also included hazard tree removal on 310 miles of National Forest System roads. An alternative legacy sediment site treatment plan was approved for this project. The plan required treatment of 68 of the highest risk sites, and the schedule for treatment of those sites extends to 2024. To date, Klamath has treated 17 of the 19 sites required to be treated by 2019, and one site that was scheduled further in the future, which is why it says 18 sites. 15 of the treated sites required replacement of existing crossings with culvert size for the 100-year flood. And Klamath estimates that over 16,000 cubic yards of sediment savings have resulted from the treatment so far. And the cost of treating the 18 sites is estimated to be over $815,000. Now I'm going to shift gears and provide an overview of grazing on federal lands and discuss implementation of waiver requirements for grazing allotments. This map shows all National Forest System lands in the North Coast region, and here are all of the Forest Service grazing allotments. There are a total of 140 Forest Service grazing allotments located within or partially within the region, and of those, 91 are active, 46 are vacant, and 3 are closed. And together, all of these grazing allotments on National Forest System lands cover 22% of the land area of the region. This slide shows how the process of enrolling in allotments under the waiver was supposed to work. Starting with an approved NEPA for a new or revised grazing permit, one that would incorporate the results of allotment monitoring required by the federal waiver, which I'll discuss on the next slide. That would be followed by a federal agency submitting an application for coverage under the waiver and resulting in enrollment of that allotment under Category B. The monitoring and reporting program for the waiver was revised in 2015 to require additional information on national forest grazing allotments. We required each national forest to evaluate a subset of allotments each year and prioritize allotments for monitoring that were scheduled for NEPA permit renewals. This monitoring is required on allotments whether they are enrolled under the waiver or not. The monitoring focus is on evaluating the conditions of stream banks, riparian vegetation, and wetlands and wet areas in key grazing areas on allotments. And the monitoring and reporting program also requires each national forest to submit the results of annual grazing permit compliance inspections. We also required each national forest to collect indicator bacteria sampling on one allotment per forest per year. They would collect 5 E. coli samples prior to the onset of grazing, and then 5 samples during grazing. And the objectives of all of this monitoring were twofold. The first was to answer the question, after over 30 years of implementation, are federal BMPs for grazing protective of water quality? And to require national forests to incorporate the results from this monitoring into their NEPA analyses so that the resulting grazing permit renewals would reflect the monitoring results. However, the goal of informing NEPA process for grazing permit renewals has not worked out as we'd hoped, as we have not had received any applications for Forest Service grazing allotments under the federal waiver since adoption in 2015. Excuse me. We did enroll 2 allotments under the 2010 waiver, but no allotments have been enrolled on any national forests since 2012. So in total, we've enrolled 2 of the 91 active allotments on National Forest System lands under the waiver. And why has this happened? Largely as a result of legislative changes over the past 10 years to relax the grazing permit renewal requirements for federal agencies. Under the old process, which we relied on when developing the 2010 and 2015 waivers, each national forest was required to submit a schedule for renewing NEPA for grazing permits and then cycle through all active permits on a 10-year schedule. Now, in each federal appropriations or spending bill over the past few years, Congress has extended federal agencies a pass on the requirement to renew expired or expiring grazing permits in most circumstances. As the waiver relies on the NEPA process to enroll projects, this leaves us and federal agencies in a situation where very few of these allotments, which cover a significant portion of our region, are subject to the conditions of this waiver. Now I will describe results of indicator bacteria monitoring conducted under the monitoring and reporting program. For comparison's sake, I evaluated the results of all samples collected against the statewide E. coli standard that became effective under state law earlier this year. We recorded a total of 5 exceedances of this standard during grazing samples from 2017. 4 exceedances of the statistical threshold value of 320 colony-forming units per 100 milliliters of a sample, and one exceedance of the six-week rolling geometric mean standard of 100 colony-forming units per 100 milliliters. No exceedances of the E. coli standard were recorded in 2018. And the narrative objective for indicator bacteria is the bacteriological quality of waters of the North Coast region shall not be degraded beyond natural background levels. We did find that E. coli concentrations tend to increase after cattle turnout dates. So this chart shows the results of E. coli sampling required by the waiver. These data are expressed in terms of CFUs per 100 milliliters, and the vertical axis is plotted on a log scale. Individual pre-grazing samples are shown as green bars, and during grazing samples are shown as tan bars. Note that the gaps in this graph show sampling events that did not detect E. coli. The standard the statistical threshold value and geometric mean are plotted as horizontal lines, and exceedances of those standards are plotted as colored dots. This chart summarizes a total of 110 samples collected since 2017. Please note that only results where five samples were collected pre-grazing and five samples during grazing are shown on this graph. Modoc National Forest struggled to collect samples before their streams dried up and was unable to collect all of the required samples on any allotment in any year. And the permittee on one allotment sampled on Klamath National Forest in 2017 did not graze the allotment, leading to no during grazing samples being collected. And as a result, those data are not shown on this graph. The indicator bacteria sampling effort has required a great deal of Forest Service resources to collect the data, largely as a result of the remote nature of some of these sampling locations. And one of the primary challenges we have found with grazing permit administration is the limited staffing for grazing allotments in the national forests, given how many and how large grazing allotments out there are. Many grazing permits are more than 10 years old and may not incorporate management measures that reflect the current thinking of range science. And many allotments, especially in the western portion of our region, do not necessarily have riparian fencing or other exclosures that keep cattle from accessing sensitive areas. And the Federal Wilderness Act of 1964 established wilderness areas in some portions of our region on federal lands and allowed for continued grazing, but that act prohibits the installation of many physical best management practices, such as riparian fencing in wilderness areas. Now I will quickly discuss the monitoring and reporting program for the waiver. Please notice the designation on this slide that this is a Forest Service monitoring and reporting program. The monitoring and reporting program was largely developed with the 2010 Forest Service waiver, and as stated previously, relies primarily on Forest Service monitoring methods and protocols. This also reflects the fact that the Forest Service controls the majority of federal land in our region and enrolls the majority of the projects. The federal waiver also lays out a process for other federal agencies to propose an appropriate monitoring and reporting program for their enrolled projects, subject to executive officer review and approval. So broadly, the required monitoring can be broken up into two categories. There's forest-wide monitoring, which requires each national forest to evaluate in-channel conditions across national forest system lands in our region. And then we require them to summarize monitoring that they already do, such as storm patrols after large storms and the development of burned area emergency response or bear reports after fires. And we also require project monitoring for Category B projects. And that includes the development of implementation and effectiveness checklists to evaluate installation of on-the-ground prescriptions and best management practices. And we also require annual assessments of specific grazing allotments, as I discussed previously. We require each national forest to submit draft allotment monitoring plans that contain the allotments they're proposing for monitoring by March 1st of each year, and then annual reports by July 15th that summarize all of the required monitoring in the monitoring and reporting program. And by April 15th, 2020, each national forest is also required to submit a five-year retrospective report that summarizes all of the monitoring conducted under this term of the waiver. We plan to meet with the Forest Service and other federal agencies later this year to work on details of proposed revisions to the existing waiver and to inform development of a public draft permit. During the public comment period, probably in the early spring, we expect to hold a workshop where the board will consider proposed drafts or changes to the permit, but will not take any action. And the comment period will close after that workshop. We will then consider and respond to public comments and propose and then develop a proposed permit to bring to the board prior to the expiration of the current permit in October 2020. Now I'll wrap up with a discussion of what's working well, areas of improvement, and end with some potential revisions to the next permit. Here are some areas where the waiver is working pretty well. The Category A process works pretty smoothly, and the Category B enrollment process also works well. And we appreciate that representatives of federal agencies have requested many pre-enrollment evaluations of projects to resolve issues prior to submitting applications. Alternative legacy sediment plans and trading of legacy sediment sites affords federal agencies more flexibility in developing the required legacy sediment site plans. As discussed previously, we have encountered challenges with grazing allotment enrollments and grazing allotment monitoring. Several national forests have requested a more clear path to delisting portions of federal land from the Clean Water Act Section 303D Impaired Waters List. And we have received feedback that some of the conditions in the monitoring and reporting program are unclear. So some potential revisions include a revised approach to permitting grazing allotments, whether that's through the next version of this permit or a different permit, to encourage watershed level sediment reduction efforts, such as the watershed condition framework, and to improve the clarity of monitoring and reporting requirements. So just to recap, after I take any questions you have, we'll next hear from Bureau of Land Management, and then several staff from the Forest Service will give a panel presentation. And that concludes my presentation. Does anyone have any questions?
Thank you very much, Forrest. Board Member Corbett?
yes. First of all, there's a suggestion the last time we consider it that we be looking at some of the differences in characteristics of some of the different forests. Is that on the table? Has that been looked at? And what's the status of that?
As far, in what way would we?
It was commented by two board members that there are different vegetation regimens, different soil, and considerable differences between some of the national forests, and that should be looked at and considered when we come back with a revised permit. And so I wondered whether any progress had been made on that or thought on that, or whether staff has rejected that, or what is the status? Because I know that was our clear direction.
Hi, Dean, proud of your staff. I'd like to help Forrest with that question.
Sure.
So he mentioned like the distinction and the monitoring for the Modoc National Forest. We recognize there's some really distinct differences there. The short answer to your question is yes, it's on the table.
Okay, great.
I think what you're speaking to is if we compartmentalized portions of the waiver to address specific practices, plans, geology, all that sort of thing. Am I understanding your question correctly?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And I would just add, this is Matt St. John, that the framework of the waiver that allows for or that covers projects on a project by project basis, it means that individual projects that have by nature different site conditions are reflected as in the review of that project and in the potential additional conditions that can be imposed when a particular project is reviewed and enrolled in the waiver.
Well, and of course, that's a good process, but on some of them, there may be patterns.
Sure.
That could, and the problem, the more individualistically you tailor it, the longer, more complicated the permit process, and I'm trying to have us look at keeping it moving. Also, and this is much larger than this, but When I first came on this board, we sought the first 303D delisting, and we actually got a couple. But the process is pretty chintzy, and also it's sometimes given to the regional board to list and sometimes to the state board and back and forth. But I think it would be good to get a presentation to this board on progress we've made on delisting, what are the criteria, and what are the prospects, because if you look at our region, most of it's listed. Well, maybe we're the most polluted place in the world, but maybe we're pretty healthy on our listings. And so I think that issue, that's a broader issue, and there needs to be a study session where staff comes and presents on that back to the group. And then I also appreciate staff, and clearly some of this needs to get directed to the Forest Service on their working together, but the federal anti-deficiency statute on budgeting is a very challenging issue on these types of regulations, and that's a much bigger issue than us. That's a national issue, and it's all budgetary issues, and it's based in the Constitution and Congress. And what I have found is many of the agreements with the federal government get mushier and mushier over that issue, but generally they've had good faith in carrying out the intent of them. And then also we can't predict what Congress is going to do on the budget for them, and I wouldn't advise us spending a lot of time on it, but that does affect their ability to comply in good faith, and so that's just something we have to work with. And I really appreciate where you've taken the permits. We're going in the right direction. And if you look where we started out, people didn't think it was a question of whether any permit at all. And we've really moved beyond that.
Other questions or comments? Board Member Gant.
So looking at all the activity in the forest land in our region, what percentage of that activity is Category A and what is Category B? I mean, is it?
That's a good question. I have the acreages for Category B, but because projects are enrolled automatically, tracking all of the Category A projects, and I don't have that information here.
Do you have a sense, 50-50, 30-70?
If I had, you might hear more about that. You might hear more about that in the Forest Service presentation.
But I'll go ahead and give you the punchline: is that we estimated that there were hundreds of Category A projects. I think Forest identified 33 Category B projects. Yeah. So just to give you a sense.
Oh, okay, that's good. And what's the other one? So this one will be for the Forest Service, so I'll wait on that one. And then I had, so when we are working on fire recovery projects, what's our timeline for getting all our work done for the Forest Service to move forward? I know that there's a big complaint in Trinity County and in the Shasta Trinity of things taking a long time to get going, and I'm wondering, what is our turnaround time? When they come to us and say, we need this permit, how fast can we turn over stuff to them?
We respond within the time frames that the Forest Service dictates for their public review for their environmental analysis. And then once we receive the Category B application, we have up to 30 days to enroll the project. And so somewhere from a few days to 30 days it takes. I don't know that we've taken up to 30 days to actually enroll a project, but
okay.
that's a condition of the waiver itself, the 30-day turnaround.
Okay. I'll pass for now. Board Member Norrie.
Forrest, thank you, by the way, for the information. This is a permit that's, as you say, this is third term of this permit. When these permits get to this state, I believe there's the benefit of hindsight. There's also the benefit of them looking forward. I know that from, you know, as you presented today for us, that this is a permit that's then coming back for renewal in about a year hence from now. A couple things. I recognize that given the state of the world these days, and from an environmental standpoint and climate, that I would imagine that the fuels management and the vegetation management here is going to be a growing component of this program. And yes, that I would just ask, as this comes back, I'd like to understand that better. How do you build bandwidth into that, whether it be something like Board Member Gant expressed, where I remember when Westside Project came up for enrollment, and there was Westside was big, as I recall. If you look at some of the complex fires that happened this last season, bigger, you know, and I think that's the expectation here. So I think that in the spirit of the question of, I appreciate, Dean, that, you know, 30 days is they have a NEPA requirement or an enrollment on their side. They're working under federal rules. I don't think we're an impediment to that enrollment, but there's a lot of due process that happens in there. I'm interested in hearing going forward, doesn't have to be today, about how then that process and how we work within probably a growing piece of this permit. And I would imagine that's all Category B, or it might not qualify for Category B based on size and complexity of some of these events. Interested in that. By the way, I think you're right to look in and question, or at least set what I believe was up there, a pathway to delisting, right? I think that's important here. I think that door swings two ways. From the monitoring standpoint, my expectation with monitoring is that it's informative, is that it tells us something. And my question to you would be, in looking forward and renewing this permit, is it informative enough to ask these and answer some of these questions? I believe these are mostly sediment impaired watersheds. Probably temperature goes there with that. Yes. I'm not aware myself of indicator bacteria being an impairment here. It is a water quality issue for sure. And that the riparian monitoring, I believe, was qualitative assessment in large part. That was the intent of it. I would be interested to hear when this comes for renewal about how then the monitoring, does it answer that question for us? I think it's important for us to look at not only where we're at, but where potentially we could go. We're looking at a dispersed landscape with different landforms and land types here, whether it be Modoc or Six Rivers or Trinity. They're different. They have different land uses. They have different climate, and they have different water quality challenges. I would be interested in hearing how then this kind of wraps together to inform that bigger question, because is it telling a story that then we can inform ourselves to better position water quality issues to be front and center, or is this really just a great job out here and there's not an impairment? By the way, I can appreciate the complexity of doing bacterial monitoring in remote areas. A lot of that stuff has an 8-hour hold time. So to go out and sample in the middle of Six Rivers National Forest and get it back to a certified lab in 8 hours, maybe you send it there by carrier pigeon, I don't know. But the thing is, that's got to be tough. And that, you know, there are a lot of allotments out here. It is a bit challenging. I wrote down that it's 22% of the National Forest land base has allotments on it. We've certainly heard in the past and had information that these allotments have challenges, water quality challenges. That's been brought to our attention under complaints and information we've seen. So I'd be really interested to see, as this comes up for renewal, how this monitoring is going to either tell us something now or it's going to tell us something in the future. I think it's really important so that we can be agitative and or agile and responsive to our requirements under our rules on Port of Colon and as it nexuses to some of the federal rules on land uses out here. But thanks a lot. I really appreciate your presentation. Thank you.
Questions or comments?
I just had one. We did, on an emergency basis, last permit, put in fire provisions, but they were pretty hastily drawn, and that would be something I would be very interested in getting the experience and professionalism on the Forest Service of what would be helpful on emergency fire permits, on having an expedited process. And it was a miracle we got it done as fast as we did, but what we're seeing is a consistency in the fire area that needs to be expanded and more robust. And my understanding is our staff are thinking along the same ways, but I wanted to make sure we emphasize that was an emergency first crack. We put it in. We really need to make sure it's a system that the Forest Service can live with and make sense, and also to inform us. We're still learning how to regulate these fire situations, and
I think
wisdom of anybody would be helpful.
I think you'll hear more about that from the Forest Service.
Okay.
So.
Well, thank you. I think, well, we can move on to the BLM presentation.
Yep. Thank you.
Good morning, board. My name is Sam Flanagan. I'm a geologist here in Arcata with the Bureau of Land Management. I'll qualify before I dig into this. We're very new to the waiver process. Forrest showed the bar charts there. I think we had one or two enrolled projects. So I'm going to touch lightly on our experience with this, and then a lot of this is going to be kind of what we do here locally with the BLM and kind of looking forward to that 2020 renewal effort that we'll be a part of. And so just want to add some more information from the BLM perspective and how we do things and sort of the issues we face. Locally here, our BLM office is driven a lot by restoration and recreation. We have a number of grazing allotments. I'll talk a little bit more in detail about that. As was touched on earlier, fuels and fire is an up-and-coming thing, and I'll explore that a little bit more. And I really want to point out for a lot of the work we do, particularly in the restoration, recreation arena, partnerships are essential for us getting work done, whether it's nonprofits bringing in grant funds or us through cooperative agreements giving money to nonprofits to actually do the project on the ground. So there's oftentimes with our projects a big cast of characters getting the work done out there and sharing resources. And in a lot of instances, relative to the waiver process, we may take on the permit responsibilities while the nonprofit partner group takes on the contracting and the implementation of it. So it can get complex in a hurry with larger projects. And I should throw out, I'll count the Water Board staff as a partner in some of this, especially for some of the small habitat 401 permitting and some of the streamlining that's been done for small habitat projects. It's been a huge help for us getting some good stuff out on the land happening. There we go. One thing I want to emphasize in this slide and the next slide, I know it's pretty zoomed out. Our BLM ownership is very scattered across the coast ranges from southeast to Covelo up here to Lax Creek near Redwood National Park. Some of our more noteworthy larger tracts of the King Range down south here on the coast, Headwaters, Elk River. But a very scattered landscape ownership pattern, almost half of it's in wilderness. A lot of it we can't get to unless we know the right rancher to call and the right combo and the lock to get to some of these hinterlands out there. Just zooming in, and the Eel River is kind of the classic example of that. A lot of scattered tracts, a lot of 40-acre, a lot of 80-acre parcels out there. That has implications for our grazing allotments. I'll talk about that in a second. And really one of the take-homes here is rarely do we manage a whole watershed setting or have access to a main stem channel. A lot of our Eel River landscape in particular is sort of holdover from the old Homestead Act, where nobody wanted the rocky ridgetops. So those are all in BLM ownership. So you'll see a lot of ridgetop grassland, rocky knobs. Shifting gears a little bit, there was some talk about legacy sediment inputs and considering those during waiver applications. We would submit in a lot of our larger watersheds. This is Lax Creek up near Redwood National Park in the Redwood Creek drainage, that we've treated just about all of the legacy source inputs. What's left are incredibly difficult, expensive, and just ground disturbing efforts to get to. Either that or they've already done their thing and failed. About 10 years ago, we completed throughout the in context with other partners, a big Upper Redwood Creek watershed roads inventory, sediment source inventory, and then through partner grants, BLM funds, we've taken out a big chunk of the roads. In LACS, I think we've treated about two-thirds of the road network. In the case of LACS Creek, we wanted to retain a lot of the roads for land management, forestry activities, recreation. So more of an emphasis on road upgrading, and decommissioned about a quarter of the road network. I think we started out with 60 or 70 miles of road, and took offline about 20 miles of road, something to that effect. So huge effort out there with inventory, prioritization, and putting a lot of money on the ground out there. Same story for Headwaters and the Elk River right here out of town, and Salmon Creek. We've hauled out to hopefully stable storage spots about 1 million yards of fill from crossings. We've treated about two-thirds of the road network is gone out there. What's left are some of these little stringers of roads along ridgetops that really aren't a sediment source, or they've already done their thing, or they're incredibly difficult to get to, would require a lot of reconstruction across unstable slopes to get to one or two crossings. And I think it was brought up in the questions here a second ago, sort of our focus for the next year, a couple of years, particularly in LACS Creek, is going to be fuels reduction, forest thinning. A lot of our lands up there are acquired lands, have a history of intensive timber harvest, have come back as overstock stands, heavy tan oak. The tan oak's sort of blown down, snowed down, huge fuel hazard out there. We just received a multi-million dollar grant over several years. This project is enrolled as a Category B project to start getting a handle on fuel loading, forest health, sudden oak death issues out there in the watershed. And this is just an example of the heavy equipment operations out there masticating the trees. The top two are a before, after, and then a lot of it, if it's on slopes greater than 35%, hand crews are in there treating the stuff. As an office, we do a lot of in-stream restoration work, and again, a shout out for the small habitat project, streamlining efforts there. We do a lot of work in the Matoll, where we do, in contrast to a lot of our other tracks, we do have access to some of these main stem river channels, the lower Matoll, and some key tributaries in the upper Matoll watershed. Grazing, we have 11 allotments. Our grazing pattern is interesting, and I showed you that checkerboard, not checkerboard, but kind of scattered tracks where we have, if you look on the right there, we have a ridgetop grassland. The neighboring rancher owns a couple of thousand acres around the 80-acre parcel. And so a lot of our allotments are what our grazing manager calls incidental allotments. We get the cows that are coming up from the ranch lands, and it's either a trespass grazing, or we write it in as an allotment and manage it through our allotment process. How we do that is every 5 years, we cycle through about two, three, four a year, and do a comprehensive interdisciplinary team. We review the conditions out there, make any changes necessary. And I think we've invited a few water board staff for a couple that are coming up this summer just to see the BLM process for grazing, and our rangeland health assessment process. We do a lot of recreation. I think we've got a couple that we deem Category A projects, a lot of mountain biking, trail construction. One of the big issues we face, and this is somewhat relevant to the waiver, and I went out with board staff several weeks ago where we're doing a big road upgrade project where BLM gets money through our engineering deferred maintenance pot of money to upgrade roads. And the issue we face is the BLM maintains a number of easements through private lands. We came in the 70s and the 80s, and we condemned these private roads. We took them on because we wanted to haul timber out through an active timber program. We no longer have that timber program, but we still are stuck with the road and the maintenance through private lands. And as you all know, federal budgets for road maintenance have gone down. We don't have that timber program, and the road use has gone up for a number of reasons. In this area, it's mainly cannabis cultivation. So this is Red Mountain Road up there in the upper right. We manage that whole road out to near Highway 101, so you can see there's several miles of road that traverse a lot of private land. And we've been exploring ways to sort of bring in the private landowners in a partnership. But it's a real pickle for us because we can't sort of sanction a federally illegal product on a federally maintained road. So it's putting us in a difficult spot. Anyhow, one of the issues that's sediment related. And just to kind of wrap up, this is my final slide here. The couple of projects that we have done, we've sort of developed an implementation monitoring plan that's project specific. We at the BLM, we do not have the Forest Service system and organization of the BMP effectiveness monitoring program and kind of that whole organization that goes along with it. We have, as part of our past, now aborted resource management planning effort, we did develop a series of BMPs that we've started incorporating into our NEPA documents. And then sort of written a project checklist around those to hopefully satisfy the waiver process. I think one of the fears for a lot of us staff at BLM is the monitoring requirements. We are a small staff, and given the dispersed nature of our ownership and just getting to a lot of our sites is a 5-hour drive one way, the monitoring can be quite daunting. And then, as I said earlier, we don't own a lot of the perennial blue line streams. A lot of our holdings are upslope, and we oftentimes don't encompass a whole watershed where we have kind of control over what comes out the bottom of the watershed. We do have a number of existing programs, what I call some extracurricular monitoring turbidity and suspended sediment in Salmon Creek, just down here in Humboldt Bay. A lot of groundwater low flow monitoring in the upper Mattole with partners. And as I touched on earlier, our 5-year cycling of the rangeland health assessments and a pretty active fisheries staff and interns doing extensive spawner surveys with partners and aquatic habitat assessments. So I look forward to working on the 2020 update, and that's all I have. Any questions?
Thank you very much for that presentation. Questions or comments?
Madam Chair, all I would say is, Sam, thank you for the information, by the way. I'd be really interested in, as we get towards the 2020 update to this, to see your rangeland health assessment process and just know more about it. Doesn't have to be today. If you could, you know, maybe get, I'm sure staff probably has some of that stuff, and I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, and we have staff scheduled to join us on at least one, maybe two this summer that are coming up in July.
So, sounds great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we will, maybe we'll take a quick break now before we move into the Forest Service presentation. So let's see. We'll take a 10 minutes or so, come back at 10:25. Oh, it's fine. Okay, thank you. Okay, folks, we're going to resume, and I believe next on the docket is the presentation from representatives of the Forest Service.
Good morning, Board Chair and members of the board. My name is John Exline. I'm the Director of Ecosystem Management for the Pacific Southwest region of the Forest Service. I'm here today, we're going to do a little tag team on this presentation. I'm here today with Ted MacArthur, our forest supervisor here locally on the Six Rivers National Forest, and Patty Grantham, our forest supervisor in the Klamath National Forest. So I'm going to start off and then I'm going to hand it off to Ted and Patty. Again, we appreciate the opportunity to be here today to speak to the 2015 federal waiver and to provide comments in this early phase of creating the next waiver in 2020. Again, I just want to say, convey my agency's appreciation for the strong working relationship that we've developed over the years with the North Coast Water Board staff. So just a quick orientation. I think Forrest probably already have some of these same slides, but this just gives you a quick picture of the Pacific Southwest region. There's 18 national forests in California, which is composed of the of our region, and covering about 20 million acres of land here in California. The other thing that's not shown on the map, our region also covers the state of Hawaii. We also provide services to the territorial islands out in the Pacific. So our region is a lot bigger than just California. We have a lot of blue ocean between us and those islands out to the west of us. Let's see, national forest lands too, just a quick fact. National forest lands throughout the state of California provide approximately 50% of the water supply for the state of California. And again, the Forest Service, along with both the state and all the local regional boards, are key partners in delivering clean, high-quality water to fulfill a variety of beneficial uses. Just another quick slide of the area that's covered by your board here in the North Coast. Again, there are five national forests are located within the North Coast region, encompassing approximately 5.7 million acres. Just a quick note, three of those forests in the North Coast region also have lands that fall within your neighboring board, the Central Valley Board. The issues dealt with in the past in the North Coast region has largely centered around water quality impacts from roads, mine tailings, water diversions, and many of them were illegal diversions, and illegal cannabis grow site operations. While these remain important today, we must continue that we will need to continue to address. Our comments today are going to kind of focus on an emphasis on high impact from severity wildfires or severe wildfires to water quality and what we can collectively do to better protect communities, infrastructure, and forest lands from these severe events. So probably just to reiterate, fuel conditions and extreme weather are aligning to create fire behavior and effects that quite frankly, were once unheard of or becoming the norm. In my going on my 39th year here in California working for the Forest Service, I can honestly say probably in the last 5 years in particular, the large wildfires and the effects of those large wildfires, I would never have dreamed of 20, 30 years ago, what we're seeing today. Just last year alone, we saw the effects of the 2018 wildfire season. Within the past year, the Forest Service has placed a greater emphasis on trying to address what we're calling our accelerated pace and scale restoration activities. We've been doing this with various means. We have numerous memorandums of agreements with various partner organizations. Those include both state, local governments, county governments, tribes, NGOs, conservation groups, etc. And most importantly, what these groups are really aiming to do is to address this buildup of excess fuels and the treatments and how we can accelerate some of those treatments across the landscape to prevent things like this. This is a scene from Paradise. It's kind of the aftermath, the cleanup. But this is becoming all too uncommon in California.
maybe not to the same extent, but there's communities up and down the state that we're starting to see this in. And just to put it in perspective again, the 2018 fire season, tragically, we lost too many civilian lives, and we lost 6 wildland firefighter lives last year. The 20 million acres of National Forest System lands that I mentioned here in California, a large majority of that, including the 5.7 million acres here that are covered by the North Coast Water Board, are in need of some type of treatment to try to moderate the effects of the wildfires that we're seeing now due to a lot of things, accumulation of fuels over the years, policy. There's enough blame to go around all over the place on that, and climate change. We are seeing a change in climate, and it's having that climate is causing stressors to occur, and such things as wildfires or some of the activity we've seen in the southern Sierras with the insect and tree mortality going on with bark beetle outbreaks. Again, the footprint of the treatments on national forest lands, again, must explain. They got to expand. We need to look at larger landscapes and do a larger type of restoration work to make a difference, to try to mitigate the effects on something like the campfire that occurred last year. As we look towards the development of the 2020 waiver, current requirements around the legacy site treatments is one area that we would really like to explore with staff and see what we can modify or come up with some agreement on, because we feel those requirements, along with some of the other requirements, we need to really take a hard look at in order to be able to increase our pace and scale of treatments out on the landscape. On a further note, I sit on the board, it is the board of the Forest Management Task Force. We're a key partner with the state agencies that Governor Brown had originally formed, and now Governor Newsom has continued to form on that. And I would say the federal partners, along with the state partners, we have a lot of common goals in mind. They're all on the same page. The state goal for treat 500,000 acres a year, along with our region's goal of treating 500,000 acres a year, that's 1 million acres a year that we feel that needs to be treated. And we have a long way to get there. We're not there yet, but we have a long way to get there. But I think we're all on the same page, and we recognize we want to prevent things like this in the future. So with that, I am going to hand the presentation off to Patty.
So Madam Chair and Board, my name is Patty Grantham. I'm the Forest Supervisor on the Klamath National Forest out of Yreka, California, often confused for this place. And probably vice versa a little bit. But so our presentation today is really broken into kind of 4 parts. Might be a little, might be a little bumpy along the way. But, John just covered the introduction. He talked a little bit about our need to increase pace and scale, given some of the fire challenges that we are seeing. I'm going to talk a little bit about what happened under the 2015 waiver, kind of looking backwards. My colleague Ted MacArthur is going to talk a little bit about grazing, and then I think I'm going to come back up and talk about some ideas for improving the 2020 waiver. So that's kind of how it's going to roll out this year. So, Forrest covered some of this too in terms of the Category B projects, the 33 that were enrolled. All the forests are, in addition. We didn't really count it up, but the pretty good estimate is that we have hundreds of enrollments under the Category A portion of the waiver, too, for those kinds of activities. So all forests, moving towards TMDL compliance, working towards improving water quality, doing our monitoring, and then, reporting is a little bit uneven, but by and large, submitting monitoring reports and working to get information to the board that they need and that we need, quite frankly, too. Okay. There we go. So the forests in the North Coast region have a long history of watershed restoration. And they kind of vary by forest based on staffing and capabilities. All the forests share the requirement to implement the watershed condition framework and follow the terms and conditions of the waiver. I've got a couple of slides that are going to show examples of the suite of activities that excuse me, that the Forest Service is, you know, typically engaged in. So stormproofing is a is a big activity. Significant investments have gone into both stormproofing and legacy site treatments. This slide doesn't, or it's a little bit uneven. Let's say that if we included all of our burned area emergency response stormproofing post fire activities, the mileage for the forests in the North Coast region would be about 670 miles. So that's missing off here, but that's certainly a contributor to reducing, you know, the risk of sediment movement following fires. We continue with fish passage upgrades. You know, I think that our total number under the, you know, under the waiver is probably less than 10 or 12 for this last, since 2015. However, we have been accomplishing a lot of work through partnerships and on other lands and, you know, kind of identifying the highest priority places to do this work that's going to contribute to fish restoration and really bringing to bear our efforts in those places. Without too much regard to boundaries. There's a lot of road restoration partnerships going on to the tune of about $750,000 a year. Lots of partners out there. It is it has a it's not evenly distributed amongst the five forests in the North Coast region, but the forests that are able to take advantage of these are making some great headway. I think the times when, you know, say that, you know, we want to continue with a road restoration program and, you know, you get hit with that big wildfire and you kind of have to change priorities out and do other things with Forest Service staff. This is one of the great benefits of partnerships because they continue to move things forward given those kinds of situations. So I'm going to pass along to Ted MacArthur now, who's going to talk a little bit about some monitoring and some grazing.
All right, good morning, Madam Chairman and board members. Really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. Again, my name is Ted MacArthur. I'm the Forest Supervisor of the Six Rivers National Forest. One of the things that just wanted to highlight is you know, we have limited resources, as you've heard, but we really are committed to improving water quality and doing what we can to improve these systems within the North Coast area. And this is just some of the details of the work that we're doing and trying to capture the kind of the conditions and come up with where we need to focus our efforts to improve things. This one, get into this one, I did want to toot the Six Rivers horn a little bit. We did just sign a forest-wide programmatic aquatic restoration project yesterday. So one of the things that I'm really excited about is in the 2025 waiver, highlighting some of the work that we'll be doing under that over the next few years. And in this slide, I just wanted to highlight specifically related to grazing is so Patty shared some of the active restoration work that we're doing. There's also passive restoration work that we're doing through our management of our livestock grazing permits. And this is a little bit dated, but it does highlight, you know, through management actions that we can do some recovery work there as well. This is one point that I think Forrest touched on very well, I just wanted to highlight it again a little bit, is that, you know, since grazing was added to the waiver and the specifically the E. coli monitoring, we have a modest budget to administer our range programs, and it's really important for us to focus our resources on where we can make a difference, where those challenges are. And one of the things that, you know, we feel the E. coli monitoring, it's an expensive project, it's a challenging one to implement, and it's kind of taken away from some of the efforts where we could focus our efforts that might relate to trouble spots and areas that we need to improve management on. Yeah, another component of this, these are the specific data points. We haven't had a lot of exceedances, but the ones that we have had, it's hard to determine what the causes are. We're guessing that in a few cases it is livestock, in a few cases it's probably packed stock. And one of the other kind of outlying concerns is the illegal grow sites that are on the National Forest lands. They use a lot of chemicals, they use a lot of fertilizer. We're doing our best to find and mitigate the hazards from those, but those are also adding material into the water systems that would affect this number as well, that wouldn't necessarily be a one-to-one correlation to our grazing program. The other thing I wanted to just touch on that was brought up a little bit earlier, that though we are very concerned about water quality, the E. coli is not one of the criteria for the 303D listing. We would really like to focus on the sediment and the temperature aspects that our streams are listed for. As well as one of the challenges that is hard to articulate that may not necessarily be apparent here is when we do the preseason, grazing monitoring, it's in the spring. There's a lot of water. The systems are pretty cold. The E. coli doesn't really thrive in that kind of environment. And when we're doing the during the season measurements, it's warmer. There's less water, and so there's more possibility for those introductions from wildlife, from livestock, whether they be permitted or pack stock, or other illegal activities related to the grow sites. One thing I did want to highlight is the type of monitoring that we are doing. We do quite a bit of permit monitoring. Our requirements are that we do 10% of the active allotments are monitored a year. We monitor a lot more than that because because we need to. Example I'd like to share is kind of from the Klamath. They have on all their active allotments, they have about 170 monitoring sites that they visited last year. And out of those, there were a preponderance of them were within the standards, but there were a handful of them that weren't. And there's action that's being taken on those where they're adjusting the management, potentially reducing numbers. So there's things that we are doing when we do find out that there's problems and trying to focus on that and improve the conditions in our grazing allotments. One of the challenges that we're facing here, just a highlight of one of the areas where we found an issue, recognized that, adjusted the monitoring, and can have some good recovery based off of those adjustments in management practices. One of the things that Forrest also highlighted that I think is important to articulate is the current kind of process of enrolling allotments through the NEPA schedule. We recognize it's probably not the best model. We don't get a lot of movement in moving those allotments through the NEPA process based off of our funding, and there's just not enough action there to use that as a mechanism. So we're really interested in working with our partners on the Water Board staff and finding out what's a better way that we can look at engaging and addressing the concerns there. We do have some capacity, I think, looking at how we can utilize kind of the terms and conditions of the permits, even if they are dated, using our annual operating plans, and finding out how is a better way to engage to make sure that enrolling the allotments is meeting the objectives of the Water Board and minimizing the when we have those deleterious effects. And those are really the highlights I had on the grazing, and I'm going to turn it back over to my colleague Patty to talk about recommended changes.
So I think you're going to hear a few common themes that have keep poking up in some of the presentations this morning. You know, as we look to the 2020 waiver and, you know, what could be making it better. And we really look forward to working with the Water Board staff in crafting this upcoming waiver. So the first piece is, you know, making additions to the Category A projects. Is, you know, as I mentioned, we've enrolled hundreds of Category A projects. It, you know, works really well. And, you know, we look forward to expanding that category to cover prescribed fire, mechanical fuels reduction, you know, other things that, you know, we can... we can craft to keep us, you know, sediment issues to a minimum, but again, move those forward into Category A. So we'd also like to see, you know, potentially, this is a wild idea, you know, Category C established, and to directly address treating hazards within, you know, WUI. To, you know, provide greater protection and security to infrastructure, to human life, you know, to communities, you know, that kind of thing. So I'd like to really discuss that. We'd like to see the segmentation of Category B activities from projects that combine Category, you know, A and B. And you know, forgive me, I'm sure you know, all understand the nuances of this, or maybe it's not particularly nuanced, but... a lot of times when we look at large-scale restoration projects, there will be a mix of Category A and Category B projects within there. But once you have Category B projects, it triggers, you know, those Category B conditions around legacy site treatment for that entire footprint of the A and B pieces. So, again, towards meeting some of the things that John talked about and really wanting to accelerate our pace and scale of treatment, you know, we'd like to see something like that be put in place. Let's see. We want to revise Category B Condition 2 to allow trading of legacy site treatments anywhere within a TMDL watershed and not just within the six-field watershed. We really feel that this will help us, you know, target places that are high priorities for treatment and, you know, and maybe even move us towards that delisting piece. Because we'd sure like to do some of those things. We'd like to modify the intent of the in-stream monitoring program, and again, this gets back to the delisting process and criteria and evaluation and all those kinds of things. You know, currently the waiver monitoring plan and QAP, it doesn't really identify in-channel metrics or criteria for delisting, and I think we've talked about that a little bit today, and we'd really like to get there. So we'd really like to see... I'm probably going to, you know, murder this because I am certainly not the, you know, the expert in this. But we'd like to see, you know, allowing legacy site plants to count vegetation and fuels treatment as legacy site treatment. The restoration of the forest, the, you know, the objective of reducing the amount of high severity fire out there and the benefits of reducing that high severity fire towards, you know, sediment impacts, you know, coming out of these burned areas. We think that that's legitimate, and we'd really like to find a way to, you know, thread that needle and be able to consider those treatments as kind of legacy site treatments in and of themselves. I think you've heard a little bit about the E. coli monitoring. We'd like to eliminate that from the waiver renewal. And, you know, we'd like to recognize Forest Service operating procedures as really the most, you know, useful information towards informing needed remediation and the best monitoring information that's available out there in terms of, you know, the real impacts of grazing. And we want to adopt BMP implementation monitoring process using the existing Forest Service, you know, operating procedures. So, again, this gets back to a little bit of the, you know, delisting criteria and the, you know, information that we need to collect in order to move things forward. So as John mentioned at the beginning, really appreciate the professional working relationship with the Water Board staff. You know, we go through challenging things, and I can't say enough about the professionalism of the stuff that of the people that work for you in terms of, you know, working with us. And back in our March annual meeting, Executive Officer St. John shared with us the board's vision, and it was healthy watersheds, effective regulation, and strong partnerships. And that really resounded with me, and from my standpoint, I'd make a slight change to that. And speaking from me, and that would be healthy watersheds, effective treatments, and strong partnerships. I think the three of us are available to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Questions or comments from the board? I have a question. I think it was John. You mentioned that some of the forests that are in our region also cross over into Region 5. Does Region 5 have an analogous permit that you're working with?
Yes. So when you mean Region 5, just excuse my, it's the Central Valley Water Board,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Jargon.
Because our jargon also, you'll hear the Forest Service refer to our region as Region 5 also. So, slight thing. But the answer is yes. In fact, we are working with both the Central Valley Board and the Lahontan Board right now. They're going through the same process. They're looking at a little different tactic. They're going with a general order. And so we've been working with them probably for the last year and a half on that process. And I believe, don't quote me on it, I think they're looking at a 2021 implementation date, somewhere in that neighborhood. So we've been working very closely with them. Both us and the Bureau of Land Management are involved in that.
Are the requirements of that permit, are they pretty similar to this one? Is there a lot of variation?
There are some variations and some differences, and I forget which board member brought it up, but we're also dealing with some different conditions. And again, I think both the Central Valley and the Lahontan recognize two of the various conditions. When I look at the east side of the Sierra Nevada and the Lahontan covering all the way from Lassen all the way down to the San Bernardino and some of those high desert systems, pretty dramatic differences in the ecosystems and the geology that you see there. So there are differences out there. So, yeah, that's all I can tell you. There are differences.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. John, question for you. I believe that I made a note here that you said that basically with the partnership there's about 1 million acres per year that are being inventory for fuel management. Is that correct?
Yeah, what I was alluding to, if you saw Governor Newsom's executive order, yes, back at the beginning, he was directing the state, he would like to see 500,000 acres treated per year on state and private lands. Forest Service back in 2011, our regional forester came out with a leadership intent around increasing pace and scale, and in that four-page leadership intent, he addressed the issue that we felt we needed to treat 500,000 acres just on the federal side alone. So when you add the two together, for the state of California, we're looking at 1 million acres being treated per year. Again, working with our partners at CAL FIRE, we feel that's needed to make a difference on the land. Well, when it comes to reducing the threat of some of the pictures we showed up there.
Yeah, and I believe it also gives some type of indication of the magnitude here, right? That I mean, 1 million acres a year is no small chunk, right?
But no.
I mean, here we are in the North Coast where there's 50 million acres alone. Not that every one of those is going to be managed by the hand
right.
of man.
Correct.
But it does give some order of magnitude. It also, you know, you showed pictures of the campfire in Paradise. You know, I live in Sonoma County and, you know, lived through some of that stuff, and thank God it didn't burn my house down. But, it's really interesting that I believe that there's those conditions exist throughout California. It wasn't special in Paradise, nor was it special in Sonoma County. And we have an urban wildfire interface out here that is really stocked with catastrophic conditions, potentially, that it really raises the issue, as it has through either Governor Newsom or through the federal system. But at the same time, it gives some type of indication. This is like painting the Golden Gate Bridge almost, right, that you get to one end of it and you pretty much turn around and go back and start where you started. And there's a heck of a lot of inventory out here to potentially get to.
That's correct. And if you just sat down and did the numbers, we were able to treat 1 million acres a year. Eventually, that would get into a maintenance-type regime. And, of course, treatments would be a lot different once we got initial treatments done and got into the maintenance. So cost-wise, it will be a really steep increase of resources or money to be able to reach that 1 million acres. But I anticipate that would level off and actually start to decline once we were able to get those initial treatments done.
And I imagine those are prioritized around urban centers, potentially, you know, that you try to prioritize that on a risk basis. And I'm not thinking you'd go out to the top of Snow Mountain and do fuel reduction, that maybe you'd center around your communities first.
Correct. And yeah. The state, you should be familiar with, the state calls it the 45-day report that the Cal Fire put together in the 35 communities that they came up with. We're actually working with this with various state agencies right now, along with, as I said, other partners, including local governments, timber industry, NGO groups, and trying to really strategize where we need to put some of these treatments. And it's not just on the federal side, but it's also on the private and the state side. I can't tell you how many fires I've been on where there's been great treatments on one side or the other, but fire always seems to find that gap, right? You find a way through areas that aren't. So trying to be more strategic. All I can say is the state has put tremendous resources towards this effort. Federal government's putting a lot of resources toward this effort, and we really need to combine those efforts and put treatments where we can actually see some results.
Well, I think on the other side of this, you know, the intent of this waiver, it was to include then some of the fire actions and recovery work. And I just wonder out loud, is it just bigger than what this waiver can do, right? Seeing some of the size, scale, and intensity of some of these conditions that are out here and some of the outcomes, certainly the water quality impacts from catastrophic wildfires are incredible. And that, you know, for us, we have this program. I just wonder, in the categories that are here, is it too big? Is this too big of an issue to cover under this program? I just posit that as a question out loud.
So, the waiver. Oh, I will speak to the mic. You betcha. So I think the waiver, like, you know, all good policy and all good things, was built using the rearview mirror.
Sure.
And so I think that question you brought up is a really good one in terms of, you know, what are we going to see, you know, this year? What are we going to see next year? And, you know, what do we need to address that? I don't have the answer to that, but maybe we can get a little closer with some ideas for 2020. I don't know.
John, did you want to add something to that?
Well, part of the idea of the waivers is that you can expand the boundary to the level of damage beyond specified waste discharge requirements to give a lot more. You could tailor it to very large acreage. That's one of the theories behind and why a waiver right now might make more sense than a waste discharge requirement.
Yeah.
I also wanted to thank you for your suggestions. I thought each one was very thoughtful. And certainly some of them Chris is going to be subject to public hearing and agree with. Other ones, I think, need more exploration, but I believe I'll return the favor of your compliment. Our staff has indicated how professional you are to work with, and I thought your recommendations sort of spoke to that as well. So.
Thank you. Madam Chair, can I ask one other question? Ted, can you illuminate the NEPA process and with grazing allotment and how that becomes an impediment to do grazing review here?
Yeah, there's a couple of things, and I kind of skimmed over it, but so we have the Rescissions Act that kind of gives us the outline of we need to set a schedule for doing allotment, grazing management, NEPA, and that, you know, we kind of need to stick to that schedule once it's set. But then later on, and I believe Forrest mentioned this, there was an additional legislation that essentially said, you need to prioritize that list, and you can only do as much as you get paid for to move on those allotment, NEPA plans for the allotment. And the challenge is it's a little expensive to go through the NEPA process on allotments. Yes. So we don't do very many a year. And so if we use that as our mechanism to enroll areas and that activity into the waiver, we're not going to get very far very fast, and that's really the challenge there. And so trying to find another way we might be able to enroll those is really kind of where we're at and what we're interested in.
I appreciate that, and duly noted, by the way. I'd be interested in how we could then maybe key it off of something different. I think the intent here, I grew up with 50 cows, right? I love cows. And at the same time, cows in the national forest, I've certainly been out myself in national forests and federal lands and public lands for that matter, where it's really difficult to manage cows out in the middle of the national forest. In fact, a lot of it's turn them out and let them go and try to get them back at the end of the season. And the thing is, it seems like there could be a better mechanism. The intent of this waiver, as I recall, is to really take a good look at the grazing activities, the potential effects to the riparian, the potential effects to water quality, to interface, to expect then you as an agency that has the oversight to these allotments and the activities therein, is to then to use your rule structure and maybe enhance that rule structure to assess and then to adaptively manage those, because allotments are going to happen out here, but there certainly has been to our attention, and from my own personal experience, I've seen some of the effects of that. And as you showed, Ted, I mean, they're out there, and they're really difficult because they're far off places, and they're, you know, you're relying upon a community out here to manage animals and in a national forest setting, which is very, very difficult. And I'm interested in when this waiver comes up for renewal about how can we do it better.
Yeah,
very interested in that.
I don't know that we have the answer, but we'll work on it with your staff to come up
Definitely
with some ideas. We do have some ideas.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
We have board members Bedoya and then Gant.
My question is more based on curiosity. Growing up, I used to see four-wheel drive trails, fire breaks up in the hills, up the ridge tops. And I'm curious to know what the current thought is on their maintenance or creation, given that they do deliver sediment.
I'll take a crack at that. And I'll start off by saying, you know, John mentioned about our efforts to, you know, do a more holistic landscape look in terms of, you know, ridgetop fuel breaks and that kind of thing from ownership to ownership to make sure that, you know, we're being, very effective. That being said, we still, those do have, you know, vegetation, on them. And, the idea is to eliminate a lot of ladder fuels and things that will get up into the canopy, open up the canopies a little bit. And so there is ground cover on those. And, post-fire, we water bar and, use the normal BMPs to try to control sediment post that. So I'm not sure I'm getting at your question.
Are those roads maintained, or are you creating more?
We do our best not to manage. Typically, we do our best. Typically, those are not roads. They are not roads on our system. And so, we discourage. There are some cases where they are roads on our system, and then we maintain them as our roads. But we discourage use. We use law enforcement to to discourage motorized use. We use physical barriers, that kind of thing to keep people off of those areas. There are still some problems. I acknowledge that.
Thank you.
This is first question, I think, is for Matt. So does this waiver cover activities such as recreational trails, campgrounds, marinas, that kind of stuff for the Forest Service? Because it says certain activities. I didn't know how far that went.
I believe it can address activities in campsites and marinas, but it depends on what the project would be.
So taking down trees or fixing the roads that are in those areas?
Yes, it could cover those activities.
Okay. So my question to the Forest Service, being from the Trinity Lake area, which you manage all our campgrounds and the marinas, are there changes that you'd like to make in that respect? I mean, there's things that you need to do. For example, the whole Minersville boat ramp is going to be remodeled in the next couple of years. We have the grant money from the state. You guys do. And we're going to implement that. So are there any things on the Shasta Lake, you know, which wouldn't be this district's, but it kind of overlaps in Trinity Lake and some of the other areas for getting our grounds back online, going in and getting the restroom facilities back online, getting water back online, clearing out the trees. Anything in this waiver can be done to help streamline those processes or get you through those a little bit easier?
So, you know, we're really missing the forest supervisor from the Shasta Trinity right now. And I'm not sure if anyone here has experience. So they'd be covered under Category A.
Oh, okay.
I mean, probably, right?
Yeah,
but, you know, I guess it would depend on the scale.
Depends
and
on the scale
and the impacts.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, I was just wondering, and then so the extension of that is, aside from forest, are there other activities that you do besides trees that we can look at in on this waiver to make things easier? Because I noticed we've been focusing a lot on just trees, but there, I know there's other things you might do that might fall under Category B.
Sure there are. They're just not really jumping out at me.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I think working with your staff and our staff, there may be some of those out there that at our level we're not aware of, but I think it'd be well worth exploring while we have this opportunity before we issue another waiver, if there's a chance to do that. Maybe do a little instead of hindsighting, do a little forward thinking, if we can put some of those things in there too.
Okay.
We would be more than willing to work with your staff on that too, but nothing comes to our minds right now.
Okay, thanks.
Are there other questions or comments from the board at this point? Okay, it looks like we can move on to public comment. Thank you so much. I have one comment. Okay, one more. I have one comment card so far, and it looks like a couple more are coming in. So there are two people. So public comments are 3 minutes are allotted per person for public comments. There are two people who requested in advance additional time to comment, those being Thomas Wheeler and Felice Pace. So those individuals will both be granted 10 minutes. I understand that Thomas may not need the entire 10 minutes, but just for the sake of ease and simplicity, we'll do 10 minutes for both of those and 3 minutes for other commenters. So we'll start with Thomas Wheeler.
Good morning, Board. My name is Tom Wheeler, and I'm the Executive Director of EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center. Thank you for this opportunity to give an extended public comment. EPIC monitors 5.2 million acres of public land in Northern California, and we have an interest in ensuring that this waiver works to improve water quality. To this end, we do not believe that the current waiver has been a success, namely in its failure to adequately deal with post-fire salvage logging and other associated ground disturbance. In my presentation, I will lay out how the waiver is inappropriately applied to post-fire logging projects and structural issues within the waiver program itself. So first, why does this matter? We've heard a number of times from the Forest Service and from your staff about how our world is changing. Climate change is radically affecting the forests in Northern California. Fires are becoming larger and hotter, and the fire season is extending. After a fire, sediment production does increase relatively dramatically. Fires kill trees, which cause mass wasting events as the roots structure diminishes. Fires remove canopy and surface cover, causing greater sediment pollution through overland runoff. In addition to this, we have timber-related sediment sources, such as old logging roads that already oversaturate local streams with sediment. So the regional board has a cumulative watershed effects modeling program. And after fire, virtually all streams within a fire are way above their threshold of concern. The threshold of concern is a point. It's what the regional board calls a yellow light. It indicates when there are likely going to be significant water quality impacts. So as fires increase, so does post-fire logging. In these highly sensitive watersheds, which are already at or above their thresholds of concerns, that's where these post-fire logging projects take place. It is like clockwork. Come August, there will be a fire. In the Klamath Siskiyous, by November, the Forest Service will announce a new giant project to get after some of the burned timber. This is not, by the way, post-fire recovery. That is a misnomer for what is happening here. This is salvage logging. It is trying to retain the economic value of burned timber. It is timber management, not post-fire recovery. So logging will commence typically by that next summer. In addition to the Forest Service logging, much of our lands are in checkerboards or we have significant inholdings. And California's forest practice rules are very lax when it comes to post-fire logging. We typically will have giant clear cuts adjacent to Forest Service land. All of this kind of contributes to a larger picture where you have fire effects already pushing a watershed above its threshold of significance. You have private timber management causing additional sediment pollution, and then you have Forest Service post-fire logging as well, further contributing to this through through activities that disturb soil. So this is the future for California, and the regional board needs to be equipped to meet this threat, and right now it is not. The waiver is expressly limited to projects that are likely to produce limited to moderate impacts to water quality. The waiver expressly recognizes that not all Forest Service projects will be able to fit in under this waiver, but in no point does the regional board ever actually act on that. So we have very impactful projects that are being enrolled under this waiver program in violation of the waiver itself. So your staff used the example of the West Side Project on the Klamath National Forest to demonstrate how this waiver works. I think instead the West Side Project demonstrates how the waiver does not work. So after West Side, virtually all the streams in the West Side Project were above their threshold of concern. In addition to this, we had significant post-fire logging on private lands. And then the Forest Service comes in with a massive timber sale. 5,570 acres of post-fire logging, 24,000 acres of fuel reduction, 310 miles of hazard tree removal. Hazard tree removal basically looks like a timber sale on either side of the road. They take out the large merchantable trees, usually on 100 feet on either side of the road. So this is very substantial amount of ground disturbance. So we have skidder trails, we have temporary roads, we have feller bunchers moving across the landscape, churning up the earth. And they're not just taking fully killed trees, they're also taking green trees as well. And so your staff also represented that in our region, we don't have clear cutting, which is true on green timber sales. But those rules go out the door when it comes to a post-fire timber sale. When you look at a post-fire timber sale, it is very much like a clear cut. And the Forest Service will argue with me on my use of the term clear cut here, but is because it is a post-fire timber project, and so it's functionally a different form of forest management. But it is identical from the look on the ground. We have wholesale tree removal. We have broad acres that are brought down to bare earth. And so, despite all of these high risks, the regional board never kind of considers ever not enrolling a project, never considers trying to to actually exercise its authority to protect clean water. It is often a game of trying to work with the Forest Service to get a project through. And I can understand largely how this occurs or why this occurs. It is fundamentally awkward for the regional board to have to impose restraints on the Forest Service. You need to maintain a good relationship with the Forest Service. And so, in part, I would ask the board itself, formally as a board, to have greater oversight on individual projects like these. Because staff, I feel like, probably can't have the political capital to actually enforce the waiver as it's written. I would also like to address this legacy sediment site program. I think it is largely a paper game. So legacy sediment site treatment for the waiver is often many years after the on-the-ground impacts. So we had logging occur already for the Westside project. Now, only now are they beginning to implement those legacy sediment site treatment requirements, and this is going to go on many years into the future. In an era of diminishing federal investment in public lands, I find it really unlikely that we will have the resources to meet this legacy sediment site treatment list. And each project adds to this list. So the Klamath National Forest, for example, just keeps getting a longer and longer list of legacy sediment site treatment requirements as a result of the waiver. I fundamentally am opposed to this idea that we will kick the can down the road. These are fundamentally mitigation measures, and we'll kick the can down the road for some uncertain future when we don't know that these will actually occur. So EPIC and the public need the Regional Water Board to pay closer attention to these types of projects, particularly in this current administration. So a lot of talk has been made on the importance of NEPA and the Regional Board participating in this NEPA process. But one thing that we are seeing on the ground is that NEPA is largely going out the door in the Trump administration. That we have a desire from the Trump administration to increase the cut on federal public lands, and that NEPA is getting in the way of this. So instead of doing environmental impact statements, a full hard look at project impacts, the Forest Service is increasingly relying on environmental and assessments and categorical exclusions. Right now, on the Mendocino National Forest, there's a 7,000-acre post-fire timber project that is going to go through a categorical exclusion. 7,000 acres in the Mendocino. Granted, there's a lot of acres that burned in the last year in the Mendocino National Forest, but that is a huge project that is not going to receive the individualized site review, site-specific analysis that is part of NEPA. So it's increasingly concerning that we're not having federal oversight of this type of work. Instead, everything is getting fast-tracked. There is a desire to get these things through as fast as possible. So the public needs a regional board now more than ever. It needs a regional board to come in and exercise its obligation to protect water quality here in California. The purpose of the regional board is not to promote timber harvesting, is to protect our water quality. This is why we have you here. So to the extent staff is unwilling to rock the boat, it is imperative that the board play a more critical oversight role within the waiver program. So thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you for your comments, Thomas.
I guess on the break, I went down on the microphone. I thought you did a great job of outlining the problems, but one of the dilemmas that I see in one of the environmental trade-offs on the quick response on fires is we do road maintenance on what works, and we do, and then we have legacy and some other stuff. When you have a fire, my personal experience has been, if you take 2 years and you have a perfect plan, the road's already in the creek, and many of those watersheds will already be ruined for 20 years before we can get through a lengthy permit process. And so how to get the right balance between getting in I mean, what we need is someone, the second of the smoke is even just coming out of the ground, to be upgrading the road from where it is now, which they can also use for salvage logging. So that's really the dilemma that I'm in, is we have a lengthy Forest Service process that results in pretty, well, you may say good plans or bad plans, but better plans than with no plan. But then the maintenance and all these other things gets tied to that, and we can lose the watershed while we're talking about it. So that's sort of the dilemma. And I don't particularly, I thought Westside had all kinds of problems everywhere. And hopefully it's a learning experience. It was a huge fire over, you know, overwhelmed, I think, a regulatory system not adequately prepared for it. And that's partially why we put in emergency provisions with the hope that we will be developing something better. But that's the issue I'd focus on, is how do we have a timely enough process to keep the roads and the either intact or upgraded to deal with this tremendous environmental pressure they're going to get from the fires if we don't act quickly. So, anyway, any thoughts you have on that? And then
I'm sure
we can take it off record and discuss it more.
Sure. Through the chair, I would say that burned area emergency response largely does what you're saying. That is the Forest Service's ability to come in right after a fire and do the road fixes that are necessary to prevent immediate problems within the watershed. And so that's something that is often distinct and separate from these projects. In fact, burned area emergency response is not supposed to be used as a way to facilitate future salvage logging, although I think probably it is misabused in that way. So I agree on the need that we need to do something about our road network. I posit that it is probably not through salvage logging that we deal with our way too many inadequately built forest roads. Thank you, John.
Board Member Gant.
So do you have a list of changes that you'd like made to the waiver? I mean, the Forest Service gave us their list. Do you have a list?
Sure. I'm happy to present a list when we go through the development process. I think that inherently we should think about putting size limits on the type of projects, that we should perhaps make our cumulative watershed effects models mean something. Right now we do all of this modeling, but then it never actually affects the ultimate decision making in the project. This is also one of the larger critiques of NEPA, is NEPA doesn't require that the agency do the right thing. It just requires that they understand the impacts of their project. And this is fundamentally, I think, what's happening here at the regional board, is that the regional board sees these problems. We have all these watersheds above thresholds of concern, but then nothing is fundamentally being done to reduce the threat to these watersheds from proposed actions.
So kind of a follow-up then. So in an ideal world, and kind of a quick oversight, what is your vision of what should be done after a catastrophic fire goes through the forest? I mean, you're not quite pleased with the way it works right now.
So from the regional board's perspective or a larger perspective of what we should do as a community?
Just as a community, just kind of a quick oversight.
I think that post-fire logging has some place in this conversation. I think that it's probably limited to areas that are going to be low impact to the environment. So this is typically roadside areas or areas that are not in some sort of high resource protection category, like late successional reserves, which are these areas that are typically thought of as set-asides for late successional related species like the northern spotted owl or the Pacific fisher. Unfortunately, I don't think that the economics will typically work that way. After a fire, the value of a dead tree is not very high, and the value increases with the size. And so post-fire logging will typically go into these areas that have been hands-off, because those are the ones that have the largest, most merchantable trees. So I think that fundamentally, post-fire logging has not been a way to try to mitigate future fire risk. I think it's largely directed at getting a return on on trees. I think that we should focus on other areas that are truly watershed restoration work, and EPIC is happy to support that type of work, and we have in the past supported components of other projects. Westside had some watershed restoration components that we did support, but we vociferously opposed the post-fire logging.
So it sounds like, you know, the assumption is that they're doing extensive logging to get merchantable trees to help fund the program. So maybe as we move forward, groups like yours can help find funding so you don't have to go and take those trees out.
I would love to help find funding. You know, as a very small environmental organization, I don't, if there was funding available, I would love to find it for my own organization first. But to the extent that we can, we're happy to work with federal and state partners to design projects, but we're often kept out of the project design process. It is largely a responsive process where the Forest Service will propose something and it will be far too large, far too impactful, and then it becomes an adversarial process where we then have to fight. We've tried to come to compromise solutions with the Forest Service in the past. We've put forward alternative project ideas. The Karuk tribe has put forward alternative projects for Westside even, and they've been routinely ignored by the Forest Service. Perhaps it is federal law, perhaps it is agency culture, but it doesn't seem like we are well equipped to have kind of cooperative solutions on these types of projects.
Okay, so maybe going forward there's a conversation of funding where we can get that to be able to do projects that aren't economical. I mean, we have to do these projects and there's no economy in it and you got to pay them for them somehow. And maybe just have, you know, we can all sit down at the table and kind of craft
Absolutely.
Stuff together. Because this, in my experience, and I'm on the Trinity Collaborative, it's much easier just to work at stuff in the very beginning and then come to conclusion. So good. Thank you.
And the
much.
Trinity Collaborative has been a fantastic example of how things could work.
Right.
Thank you for your comments. We should keep rolling. But
I did want to say, I thought on the Westside Fire, out of the gate, the most flexible party that was looking at the bigger picture actually was the Karuk tribe. Now, they got into this dilemma, however, how detailed are you going to make the plans versus this delay? That got sidetracked because they ended up having a full-scale dispute with the Forest Service that meant that they sort of were right on the brink of that issue with us and moved on, and we ended up having more time because of... But I did want to say they were conceptually, I thought, more advanced than any of us of looking at the big picture and the participation issue and some of the other points you made. I thought they gave some guidance to the future, better than the other guidance to the future we got. But
and I would love for the Karuk tribe to take a more important and aggressive role in managing their ancestral territory. They did it since time immemorial, and we've only been able to screw it up since then. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. So we have next Felice Pace with 10 minutes. Following him will be Susan Fricke. And then if there's any other member of the public that wishes to comment, please make sure to fill out a comment card.
And by the way, it's entirely possible that the Karuk tribe could take over management of a good portion of the Klamath National Forest under the same laws, by the way. We're waiting. Don't start me yet until my stuff gets up there. Okay, my name is Felice Pace. I'm here for the Grazing Reform Project, where I'm the coordinator, the Redwood Chapter, where I'm the grazing chair, and the North Group of the Redwood Chapter, where I'm of the Sierra Club, where I'm the water chair. Where can we, the people, realize the promise of clean water if it's not on our public lands? That's a question I think we all should be asking ourselves. Next. Oh, I get to do it? I just advanced like that. Okay, progress has been made. This is 2004, Petey Brucker's over on the right, and this is when I was running the Klamath Forest Alliance, and we did a roads workshop. We took Danny Hagans and the Pacific Watershed Associates over to the Klamath National Forest. We got the engineers and all out onto the ground, and we taught them about rolling dips, and it was a radical idea.
to not put in a culvert for these road engineers on the National Forest. Back then, it was a radical idea. Now it's their program. So there is progress that has been made. Misspelling down. No, that's not me. No. But more progress is needed. Too many National Forest watersheds remain impaired for sediment and temperature. Thunderstorm-triggered sediment event, Salmon River Watershed, 2015. Now, it's post-fire, the summer after fire and those thunderstorms, but a lot of the, I analyzed it, and a lot of the problems were out of the suppression area. And I'm going to talk a little bit about fire suppression and those impacts. The top three reasons that beneficial uses of our national forest remain impaired. Let me get down there so I can move. I'm a little challenged when it comes to the, bear with me, I'm over 70, so I'm a little challenged. I don't do this very often with the PowerPoints. But Forest Service management insists on keeping roads that have failed time and again with catastrophic delivery of sediment. Okay, even though KFA did a lawsuit on IRFO, and they can put in the bigger culverts, they can also decommission with that emergency relief for federal roads. Forest Service managers refuse to require grazing permit holders to implement modern grazing methods, including restoration grazing. North Coast water officials have insisted Forest Service managers eliminate roads and grazing practices that keep... Well, you guys haven't insisted that they eliminate the ones that are keeping us going. There's also, by the way, the salvage logging. I agree with that. There's two more that I'm not going to address. And the other one is fire suppression impacts. Now, everybody assumes that fire suppression is something we have to do. We got to fight the fires. Okay, but now these guys, the Forest Service managers and incident commanders, are required to have an assessment done. It's done right by staff inside the fire crew on what the probability of success is. And they, like up in the Siskiyou Wilderness, they implemented, for example, and they often implement things that are judged to have a 30% chance of being successful. We're bulldozing into riparian areas, bulldozing the wilderness, bulldozing riparian areas in the name of fire suppression with a 30% chance of success. And too often, I've looked at them ever since 87, too often these things fail, but they're doing watershed damage. Okay, next, I'm the guy here. So I'm going to go into, this is the Walker Creek Road System on the Klamath National Forest. This is these roads after the 2015 storm. They failed catastrophically. This isn't the first time. These roads failed in 87, and they will fail again. But they were put back with the IRFO funds. And what was done is the sediment was then offset. See, I am challenged here. The sediment and temperature impairment of National Forest Watershed, the Scott, Salmon, and Klamath Rivers, cannot be removed until we get rid of those roads, because they're going to fail time and again. Not all the roads, you know, the roads that they've invested in, you know, a lot of the roads are stable, but we still have roads like that. I think the offset system is not working. You heard a little bit about it already, so I'm not going to belabor this point too much. But a number of those road upgrades are done on roads that are low-risk roads. You can replace a culvert and put in a 100-year culvert on a low-risk road. It was low-risk to fail anyway. The other thing that has not been really studied is we're taking really steep slopes, and we put in these rolling dips with the bigger culvert and then the rolling dip, and then they put big boulders down below, right below that, to hold the road there often. When those things fail and those big boulders come down, are they going to take out more of the sides of the channel? We don't know. It hasn't been studied. It's a new technique. But we don't know that. But this sediment offset is not working. We're still staying impaired. We're not getting there. So we are very supportive of doing the kind of monitoring that will monitor where we are in relationship to these things.
Now I'm going to shift to grazing. The grazing reform project, this is what we've done over the course of the last, this will be our 10th year. 1,949 volunteer hours, 244 8-hour days on the ground. 19 grazing allotments on 3 national forests, 33 photo-illustrated allotment monitoring reports, and numerous requests to managers and regulators, including to your staff, asking them to address the actual water quality, wetland, and riparian degradation that we've documented on the ground. Okay, with field notes and photo illustrated. So, finding one, wetlands are being trampled, fragmented, drying out. And by the way, these climatic differences we have between our national forests, the headwater basins in the mountains are very similar across our region. There are headwater basins typically dominated by wetlands. And this is on the left, you have a willow wetland that is naturally dense. It's outside a grazing allotment. On the right, you have the Back Meadows area of the Big Meadows allotment. Your folks have been out on it on a field trip years ago, back when we had a collaborative approach with everybody. But that's severely fragmented and being turned into a grassland through trampling. They push through in the spring to graze underneath, and then in the fall, they browse, eventually from the top. And, you know, so that's severely fragmented willows. And there's riparian areas running down through them, by the way. Finding two, grazing is degrading riparian areas via bank trampling, shade remover, and direct deposition of bovine waste. That's a chiseled bank. That's a riparian areas where the willows have been just pretty much wiped out and severely impacted where they're still there. Direct and indirect deposition of bovine waste. On the left there you have Taylor Lake in the Russian Wilderness, Klamath National Forest. Very popular. It's only a half a mile in. They a few years ago they did it so it's wheelchair accessible. They fixed a trail so wheelchair people can get up into the wilderness. Kids from Etna use this, and the Scott Valley use this a lot for swimming with their families and fishing. And now we have deposition of bovine waste directly into it. We had eliminated that with previous administrations, but now we're working on doing it again. And there's on the right is Long Gulch Creek, and you see the indirect deposition. You know, they put it in an area where they went down to drink, and then when the water gets higher, it'll get mobilized and delivered. Restoration is needed, but foresters, grazing managers have shown no interest. This is Long Gulch Creek, where we've proposed restoration. NIMS is supporting the idea of restoration. So far, we haven't been able to get the Forest Service on board. And by the way, you can put fences into wilderness. There was something was said earlier by Forest, I think, that is just not true. You can have fences to control grazing in wilderness. It's just that it's policy of the Forest Service not to put those in there. And I advocate putting them in there, okay, because it's what's needed. If that's what we need to keep them out of the riparian areas, let's have fences in wilderness. Well, there's a monitoring and reporting program has been talked about a lot. We're going to work with your staff on that. I'm going to try to go to the end and summarize. I can just summarize by saying, you know, there are some problems out there. There are things that are working. There are things that aren't working. I think that there's room for us to work together, and we're going to try to work together in order to get the job done and get a better waiver, because we really, will it shut up? We really need to, when I shut up, it'll shut up. We really need to get rid of these sediment impairments. I think that's where we have common ground. Sediment and temperature impairments, and we need to get rid of them. So let's get a waiver that's going to move us down the pike. Thank you so much for accommodating me and turning off the noise.
Thank you for your comments, Felicia. I have a question.
Sure.
You mentioned on one of your slides, I think it was the number was 33 reports.
Yeah.
Those are the reports from your project available online?
Yes, they are. They're totally available on the website. And by the way, I decided not to do paper. In your inbox for your account, there should be this PowerPoint. But online, and anybody else that wants it, you know, just give me a note because I'm old and I forget, with your email address, or just say send it to Patty if Patty wants one, you know. And I'll be happy to send it around. But all the reports, and some of the requests for action and so forth, those are on the website.
Thank you. Any other questions? Or
I just had one point. Clearly, you know, repair of legacy roads, putting them to bed is the big picture. I do want to say, though, one area that we've been lacking is what are the plans for fire roads? And I'm aware of one case where the whole thing was put to bed, then they had a fire and they needed to put back in that whole section to fight a fire. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So part of the process for everybody will be trying to, on this road, balance on where are we going to need money spent on upgrading a road versus taking it out because it's necessary for fire fighting. And hopefully the Forest Service can take a lead on that by saying here's where we need the roads to fight the fires, and then people can hash it out ahead of time. But I do want to say complete removal doesn't always work, and
well, John,
it's like everything else, there's a balance to it. That's all I'm trying to
say. Let me respond a little bit, because those roads I showed you in Walker Creek, nobody's going to fight fire on a steep
mid-slope
like that. But the Forest Service wants to put it back. There's also a road system on the other side of the creek that goes to the same places. So redundant roads. But managers always are going to want roads to manage.
I understand
now,
that.
Now, to respond to the other point you made, I've always advocated some of these roads we should put it not decommissioned, but put into hydrologic storage. Because then you leave the culvert and the fill right there nearby. You stick it in when you got to go in again, and then you pull it back out. So there are some approaches to that problem.
Okay, good points.
Thanks, Blue Jay. Susan Fricke.
So again, I'm Susan Fricke, Water Quality Program Manager with the Creek Tribe. What I would like to address the issues of roads too. I heard a lot of focus from the Forest Service presentation about delisting. Delisting should not be the priority right now. For Klamath National Forest, just them alone, I don't have the number on roads, but we had it on the last waiver, which was like 5 years ago now. They have over thousands of roads. And what? 8,000. And let's see, from in their presentation they did from 2015 to 2018, they stormproofed 26 miles of roads. This isn't acceptable. So instead of delisting, let's work on stormproofing these roads. Let's work on making the roads not such an issue. I would also like to disagree again. We were here years ago with you guys. That these large-scale salvage logging, post-fire recovery, which again, yes, as Tom said, is a misnomer, those projects should not be considered under Category B. We specifically requested that West Side be removed from the general waiver and be its own project, and that was denied, and it was included as this. We need to stop that process, stop that, as it shouldn't have been a precedent. These need to be different projects, whether it needs to be a certain size or whatever, it needs to be something separate. And John, the roads, like post-fire, the roads are dealt with. They have money to fix the roads. I think we need to make sure we separate out that issue. The Creek Tribe supports logging for protecting property, protecting towns, protecting roadways. We support that. Like they said before, we had our own alternate. We had a Creek alternate for the west side that included protecting those areas. What we do not think should be, you shouldn't be going in and clear-cutting the late successional reserves. And that's what they're doing with these things. They're going in and cutting near riparian areas. They're clear-cutting on steep slopes that are then just making the water quality issues just escalate. That's not what the waiver should be covering, and that's not what these projects should be doing. That's not protecting our resources. So I think the size and complexity, like Board Member Noren said, the size and complexity of some of these projects is way too large to be considered in that. One of the other things that I'd like to talk about is the Forest Service thing where they want to allow legacy site plans to count vegetation fuels as legacy site treatments. No. I wholeheartedly disagree with this. They should be doing that work anyway. They should be doing that work anyway because they have a federal obligation to protect tribal trust resources. And so they need to take the forestry management back to the way it was. We need to incorporate traditional ecological knowledge. We need to be doing where we're treating the forest as a whole, as a watershed, so that we can restore natural resources and ecosystem health to protect tribal trust resources. So we need to be doing things like fixing roads as part of the legacy site treatments. They should be doing things like thinning and prescribed burning as part of their thing to restore ecosystem function. And then I'd like to talk about collaboratives. Another one that we're working on in the Klamath is the Western Klamath Restoration Partnership, and this is a great partnership. I think it might, I'm not sure if it's something similar like the Trinity, but that's really how we have to do. We have to work together collaboratively, and we've had a great working relationship with our smaller NGOs, like I think Nature Conservancy's on it, Mid-Klamath Watershed Council, Six Rivers National Forest. We have, however, have not had such a great working relationship to get Klamath National Forest tied into that partnership. They have some of their staff working, but overall their policy's not on board with that. So I think as we can build those collaborations and encourage more people to be active and be a part of them, that's how we're going to restore ecosystem health for our forests.
Thank you for your comments, okay. Susan.
Any questions?
Well, I just had one comment to our staff. I think the one on these large acreage fires, we may want to have a structure for public input on conditional waivers where they ordinarily wouldn't, because you reach a certain size and scale, it is different. And so I think there's some merit to that.
Okay. I did have one thing, Board Member Gant, if I could address how you said that West Side, we need to do these projects to make money so that they have money to like do these restoration activities. For West Side alone, the Forest Service spent over $1 million on their environmental impact statement or the environmental impact report, and they brought in less than $1 million. So that project actually cost them more than it earned them because they were only getting 50 cents for like every 1,000 board feet. So that's what I also want to be aware of with these larger projects, is let's make sure that they can bring in some money, you know? Let's make them economical. Thank you all so much.
Thank you. Okay, we'll bring it back for board discussion, and I know Board Member Juicy has comments.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you all for everybody for your presentations and the information you've shared with this board today. I'm looking forward to continued discussions with these waivers. As we all know, there's so many fires. One of the consequences of having so many examples to look at, there's a lot of good literature coming out looking at immediate post-fire salvage logging, soil erosion, and sediment delivery. Jonathan, I brought this for you. It's out of the 2018 Forest Science Journal. There's really good literature review in here. I think as this discussion evolves, I think there's a lot of information here that we can, and your staff can look to help develop this waiver, again, because of all of the examples and all of the work going in to this very subject. So I thought this was timely, and I wanted to share it with staff today. Thank you. If you can just give that, and you can make copies with anybody in the room that wants it, Jonathan. I want to turn my attention to talking about grazing on federal lands. As we all know, you know, grazing is under the Taylor Grazing Act. It was developed in 1934, so it was a different era, different mindset of how these lands were to be used. Factors that go into the formulation of the fees includes private land fees, beef cattle prices, and the cost of production. Well, I looked up this morning, and if you want to raise cattle on federal land under the Taylor Grazing Act, it'll cost you $1.35 a month per animal unit. I know a lot of private cattlemen that would love for their cows to cost them $1.35 a month. I understand. So anyway, that's the basis from where I'm coming from. So as we move forward, as we go through the, and we heard great presentations today of the proportion of water that's provided by federal lands to the state of California, I'd ask staff to consider, as we look at ecological goods and services and developing the waiver, what are we going to prioritize above all else? Are we going to prioritize water and critical salmonid habitat that many of these lands produce? Or are we going to prioritize subsidized ranching? So I think, I mean, I'm hitting hard on this because I don't, and again, I know you guys are under a lot of policies, and the true stewards of these lands is Congress. Let's face it. Where the resources are going to come from, where the support is going to come from for the managers is Congress. So I'm looking for this waiver to raise a ruckus, to get attention to this topic, because it's, as John said, it's bigger than us. This is a Western states kind of issue, but I think this little board can get some attention by using this waiver, not meaning to throw you under the bus, but to elevate the awareness of what we're dealing with here. Obviously, we've heard from everybody today that the system is riddled with shortcomings and inequity. As this board continues to focus on private land grazing, I want public land grazing to be on a parallel track. If we're going to put pressure on people on private land, I think those using public resources need to be held to the same standard. The whole purpose of the Taylor Grazing Act is, quote, to improve rangeland conditions and the regulation of their use. We're within our right, everybody's within their right, to regulate this particular land use. And the other thing, too, is very clear in the Act that grazing on public land is a privilege. It is not a right, and it could be revoked because of severe drought or other natural disasters. We've had plenty of disasters on public lands in the last few years. I think all of these concepts are becoming incredibly timely, and we need to think about how we move forward, and maybe it's not just business as usual. And within the Act, erosion is specifically addressed as a criteria to be considered for perhaps denying a permit. This notion that people aren't enrolling in the process, I just find unacceptable. So anyway, if we look at roads, we've talked a lot about roads today. Well, if you're hauling cattle, you're using the same road that somebody's hauling a log truck. And I don't think, you know, $1.35 a month is going to cover the cost of maintaining those roads. So roads are being used by grazers. Trampling on stream sides is impacting riparian vegetation. It's impacting sediment. It's impacting temperature. It's right in our wheelhouse. Those kinds of impacts are exactly what we're supposed to be addressing. I certainly don't like the idea of animal waste going in the middle of a stream, but that's, and again, I think we have some regulations there, but we've heard it's difficult to monitor that. It's expensive. So, you know, let's take the low-hanging fruit. Let's look at managing those riparian areas for limiting sediment delivery and providing shade for temperature. Again, to hit hard on this, I mean, what we're talking about here is exploitation of a public resource. And I think as a lessee, they have an obligation to the public who is allowing them to use these public resources. So as we move forward with this waiver, I'd like us to maybe reconsider our paradigm and what is it we're trying to do. We're trying to protect the largest source of public water for the state of California, and that's our forest lands and particularly our federal lands. So if we rock the boat a little bit, I'm okay with that. I think it needs to be rocked. Thank you.
I agree with much of what you just said, Greg, but I also want to just reframe the conversation a little bit to recognize that grazing also is a valuable land management tool. And so I think certainly there's a lot of improvement to be made in terms of how the waiver deals with grazing, but I do think we should be keeping that in the backs of our minds as well, because you quoted the purpose of the Taylor Grazing Act and that it is a tool to improve rangeland when used correctly.
I appreciate your comments, Madam Chair, and I certainly support your comments. The only thing I would add is that maybe grazing is not important on every square foot of land on public land.
Like any tool, you don't use all the tools in all the places.
Thank you, so. Exactly.
Other comments from board?
Well, I just think we have to be very careful in our developing strategies. Certainly with a lot of people I'm with, they don't want to raise certain issues up to the highest level immediately during this particular era because they're afraid of adverse decisions. So I do think there's care has to be taken in developing the strategies without at the same time raising the issue and not backing down. But
Board Member Gant?
So I appreciate everyone's comments today, and I really appreciate it when people come to us with direct asks. It makes it a lot easier for us as a board, instead of having to sift through everything that's said and say, so what did they mean? So it's really nice to get that whole list. To the Forest and the Region 5 people coming from the Shasta Trinity, I know we have one rep here today, but there are a lot of rangers, and the fact that a Shasta Trinity person is not here at this meeting today is a problem that we've been dealing with, not as a board, but with that forest in general. I'd like to see them involved in this project. I'd like to see them in person. So that was my one heartache, because Klamath is here, which is awesome. Six Rivers is always awesome to work with, and we just need to have the Shasta Trinity engaged. Rangers? Oh, but you didn't present?
Board Member Bedoya?
I'd like to echo what Board Member Gant said earlier. She commented that a collaborative approach to figuring this out, figuring out the issues, is always best. It involves stakeholders. It involves differing opinions where you can have the opportunity to coordinate the strategies and come up with the best solution for, there's a give and take, and you find common ground and you choose something that you're all comfortable with. So I would hope that going forward a group can be created to work with staff to come up with better choices.
Madam Chair, I might as well chime in here one more time. I just want to thank you guys. I want to thank everybody that presented today. Really good comments, good conversation today. I think Forrest and Dean and the others here, I think you guys have a lot to think about to bring forward this in a year. I think there's good time to take these considerations and think about how then this, going forward with foresight and hindsight, to how this is going to look going forward. I really look forward to the conversation. So thank you very much. Great.
Any other comments? Okay. Well, I think we're ready to move on then. Thank you so much to everybody for participating in lively discussion. Sounds like there will be a lot more lively discussion as we move forward. Onward to item 8, Executive Officer's Report.
Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to highlight a couple of the articles that were in your written report. First, the article on our new grants and funding webpage. As the board and the public know, the state and regional boards, in addition to being a regulatory agency, are a funding agency. And we've recently updated our North Coast Regional Board's website to point to various funding opportunities, both from the State Water Resources Control Board and the other natural resources agencies, and just to make that information more readily available to the public that we serve. There's an article on the supplemental environmental projects policy that the State Water Board adopted in 2017. That SEP policy requires that the regions develop a list of potential supplemental environmental projects, provide an opportunity for individuals to propose projects, and then ultimately give the board the opportunity to approve that list. So what a supplemental environmental project is an environmentally beneficial project that a person that is subject to an enforcement action can voluntarily agree to undertake through the settlement process when there's an enforcement action to offset a portion of their civil penalty. And so we sent out a letter and have posted information on our website that we're currently soliciting proposals from the public, interested parties, on potential supplemental environmental projects. So again, once we receive those proposals, we'll develop a list. We'll bring it to you, to the board, for your consideration of approval at our October board meeting. And then that'll be a standard list of projects that we can go to when we're engaging in settlement talks for an enforcement action, so that we can, in a timely manner, identify and then implement projects as part of a settlement of an enforcement action. So, looking forward to getting proposals for those types of supplemental environmental projects. I wanted we did not include in the enforcement report the information on a settlement of an enforcement case, just based on the timing of when we published the enforcement report. Our staff and the California Department of Justice reached a settlement agreement with four developers in Trinity County who illegally graded roads and grow pads in a series of remote properties in Trinity County within the Indian Creek watershed. And they did this grading without the necessary state permits and in a manner that didn't implement the appropriate erosion and drainage control practices leading to erosion and sedimentation. And so we filed, the Department of Justice filed a lawsuit on behalf of this board, and in coordination with the Department of Justice and the Office of Enforcement, we reached a settlement to resolve the litigation, and it resulted in a stipulated judgment against the parties, which included a $325,000 fine, as well as includes a suspended liability of up to $200,000 that would be triggered if the party engages in future activities that violate water code provisions. Separate from the settlement agreement, there was a separate enforcement action, which was a cleanup and abatement order to actually lead to cleaning up the damaged roads and stream crossings on this property. So this was an important case. It was a priority case for our staff, and we're pleased that it resulted in this settlement with both a fine and the cleanup and abatement order to get the damages cleaned up. Couple of issues not in my written report. I just wanted to highlight that the Russian River pathogen, TMDL, is currently out for public comment. The public comment period closes next week on the 24th. Last week, we held several meetings with Sonoma County and Mendocino County supervisors, as well as county staff and other representatives to discuss the pathogen TMDL and the different components of the program of implementation, and to solicit or to answer questions and to solicit their input. We also held a public workshop to do the same thing. The public comment period, as I said, closes on the 24th next week, and then we'll be moving towards bringing the TMDL action plan to you at the August 14th board meeting. The Mr. Noren mentioned that he and Board Member Bedoya attended one of the stakeholder meetings that we had regarding the dairy general WDR, which was out for public comment. That public comment period has now closed, and we're in the process of reviewing the comment letters that we received. And we had really, really, as Board Member Noren said, productive meetings with dairy stakeholders and other interested parties to talk about the issues that had come up at the April hearing related to the monitoring requirements in the dairy permit, and with regard to the nutrient management plans and the issue of whether those plans what information in them needs to be publicly available. So we got some good input, and I think will lead to some very reasonable revisions and appropriate revisions, and we look forward to bringing that back to you for a hearing at the August board meeting on August 15th. Last thing I wanted to mention is just a couple of things regarding our cannabis regulatory program. As the board may recall from the February update, there's a July 1st deadline for cultivators who are enrolled in our regional cannabis order to either terminate coverage if they demonstrate that they're no longer cultivating and that they meet have met the conditions of our regional order, or to transition to the state water board's general cannabis order. So that's a hard deadline for either termination or transition by July 1st. And at the strong urging of the State Water Board executive management, we've issued a letter. It's actually going out today to the remaining enrollees in our regional order who have not yet either terminated or transitioned, making it clear that as of July 1st, the coverage under our regional order is no longer an option, that they have to be covered under the statewide order. So those letters will be going out, and really is just a follow-up to a series of correspondences that we've had with those regulated entities over the last year, notifying of them of this deadline. The cannabis regulatory program statewide has not generated the amount of enrollees as the state and regional boards anticipated. And so, as you all know, we are a fee-supported program or fee-supported agency. And so the fact that there have been lower enrollments statewide means that the revenue that we anticipated to support our cannabis regulatory program has not met the cost, frankly, of the program. And so the state board executive management is working with the governor's office and Department of Finance to consider how we can maintain the staffing at the level that the program has currently been funded, but it has resulted in a temporary hiring freeze. And so we have a couple of vacancies in our cannabis program just due to some internal transfers. And we're currently not able to fill those vacancies. And so that's a setback, frankly, to our cannabis regulatory program. As you know, within the North Coast region, we have a fair amount of enrollments. And so we are certainly supporting our staff. But the way that these programs are looked at is it's looked at funding for the statewide program, not from a region-to-region basis. So we're hopeful that the hiring freeze will be lifted so that we can fully staff up again to have an effective cannabis regulatory program. So I'd be happy to answer any questions about these items that I just spoke about or answer any other questions that you have.
But it seems to me the one key sense of information is how many people are growing versus how many people are enrolled, and that would both give future revenue generation and also could measure program effectiveness at the same time.
Yeah, so those are definitely metrics that we and the Division of Administrative Services are taking a really close look at.
Do we know how, or do you have a number on how many, well, probably because you're sending out letters, how many people haven't enrolled and transferred over to the state program?
My memory is it's about 1,300 or 1,500.
It's a lot of letters.
It's a lot.
So when you, a lot of stamps at 50 whatever percent.
Yeah, and we're having to send those out as registered letters since it is notifying them of termination upon this date. So it's a costly endeavor.
See, So when you, a period of time where you expect to get some response, are you going to send the counties a list? These are the people in your county who haven't transitioned? Because I know in Trinity County they're in a renewal process, and it would be very helpful to have that list and say, look, you haven't transferred.
We will definitely be working with the counties, and frankly, that's one of the challenges of there being a firm date that that this both the state board order and ours, well, I should say that some of the county licenses require coverage under a statewide permit, and so by essentially terminating folks that don't transition, they will potentially be in violation of their county licenses. And so, yes, the long answer to say yes, we will be working with the counties to notify them of folks that have that are no longer covered under a statewide order.
So in the meantime, can you do a heads up, like an email list of just the people saying these are the people we know haven't transitioned? We're sending them a letter. We'll let you know. Just so they can be flagged, the county can flag them and just not automatically renew them.
I'll work with my staff and figure out the best way to coordinate with the counties on that.
Yeah, I know our supervisors would appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you. One other question. Where are we on our aerial surveillance to a letter program?
Well, we continue to utilize satellite imagery.
Right, that's what I'm talking about. And then for what purpose do we mail out a letter saying, oh, looks like you're growing, we don't have a permit?
So as you'll recall, we have done three rounds of enrollment enforcement initiatives that utilized aerial imagery as the information to trigger individuals receiving those letters.
Right.
And we haven't done that in the last 6 months or so, just based on prioritization of different areas where we're focusing our staff resources. But it is continues, Mr. Corbett, to be a key tool that we're using as part of our compliance and enforcement program.
But we're still not doing it comprehensively, right?
We are not doing it. We're doing it in a targeted watershed framework, which is what we've reported to you in the past.
I expressed some of the challenges of the targeted watershed program and that we don't have the labor, and we got to be efficient labor-wise. That's all I can say. And
well, I think that there's perhaps continues to be a miscommunication, because I think that we're doing it in as effective way as we possibly can, and we can't do it everywhere. And that's why we are choosing targeted watersheds in order to do it where we see impacts.
Well, I'll take an off meeting further conversation.
Good.
On that.
I look forward to it.
Okay. Any other questions for Matt? Okay, then onward to item 9. Are there any board member requests for future agenda items?
Well, I had earlier suggested that we have some type of informational presentation on decertification of 303 and also we already have it in the hopper and they probably need to be combined on our looking at alternatives to the full 303 TMDL process because of the time and the expense of doing that EPA has developed. And I just want to say there are TMDLs where we're waiting to regulate potentially 10, 15 years from now. That's not a regulation at all. So we do need to keep the pressure on. And then the other big issue is the money is gone for the big TMDLs compared to what it used to be. And so we need to find what's the next step to be efficient from a regulatory standpoint.
Thanks for recapping those requests. Looks like Josh has comments.
Josh Curtis, your staff. John, I just wanted to mention that a number of the items that you're requesting are going to be part of the TMDL retrospective, which is one of our triennial review projects
that
was approved in 2018. And then Matt reminded me that in October, we're going to be doing a workshop on the 303D listing, and so we'll have some discussion on that then too.
Great. We'll look forward to those. Any other board member requests for future items?
Madam Chair, I'd like to see some discussion and an update on the legacy project, or not the legacy, I think what's it called, the project to take the TMDL for the Laguna de Santa Rosa and to make it a vision, I think it's a vision project. I'd like to see some type of information on that and going forward, how does that go forward? It's a really important watershed, and I think, you know, there's stuff happening there, but I'd like to see something about something concrete.
It's a great suggestion. We've just hired a new staff person who's going to be taking over the development or the work on that Laguna Vision project, and so probably sometime early in winter of next year we can do an information item on that.
That'd be great.
That's great news on the hiring.
Manager? So building on the forest waiver, I think we had a great discussion. I think the talk is great. Before the staff goes off and does hundreds of hours of work on it, my suggestion is that to keep us all on the same page, that we have a quick presentation by staff of what their thoughts are of the changes to the waiver prior to starting on it, so we can just kind of all see the list, all agree that those are things to work on, and then they can go off and work on the details. So just, it doesn't have to be big, you know, one PowerPoint slide with 10 items or 15, whatever the changes are. We talk about them, we all go, yep, those are what we need to work on, and then you go forward.
Good idea.
That sounds good.
Okay, well, that looks like we're wrapped on that item. Item 10, any other items of interest from Matt?
Oh, I'm sorry. I do not have any more items. I was still taking notes on the last request. Okay. I'm all set. Thank you.
Thank you. We have no closed session items today, so that brings us to adjournment to our next meeting, which will take place August 14th and 15th in Santa Rosa.
And great job, Chairman.
Thank you. Great job, everybody. Good meeting. Mm-hmm.